Hello, everyone, and welcome to Weekly Manga Recap. It's October the 5th of 2016. The world tried to stop us. The god of manga tried to send us Skype interference, but we endured and we found the most patchwork of possible ways to get the fuck around it. And we are here to talk about Air Gear, the most horrifying of all manga for the start of Halloween month.
Or don't you mean Air Ghoul, Nick?
Oh, God. I saw someone, I was looking through recommendations, and I saw someone do the Booktober. I'm like, fuck you. Thank
you. You know what? On any other day of the year, Nick, I would have probably at this point just said, fuck it. And just, like, I would have turned off my computer, and I would have gone off and say, we're just not doing a show this week. But for the Air Gear episode, I was not going to let anything stop me.
We had to do it.
A car could crash into my room right now, which is weird because this room doesn't face any roads. They would have had to have gone to like two other houses for this to happen. But right,
assassin had to go for you.
Yeah, but bet right through the side of my wall, and I'd be like, "I'll patch that up later." Now is Air Gear time. That's the commitment I have, Nick.
Yeah, I am right there with you. I've been ready for this for a long time. We started reading the manga, like, you know, around a month ago. I think I've been ready for it longer.
Mentally preparing yourself?
Yeah, getting ready for it. Since we made that a goal on Patreon, which thank you guys for helping us reach that goal so that we can torture ourselves like this. Since then, I've been getting ready for it. And, in fact, I think that maybe subconsciously I've been getting ready for it since, maybe since as long as we've known each other. Because if I remember correctly, something that we kind of bonded over early on in the time that we knew each other was you sharing stories about how fucking weird Air Gear was. In fact, I've got a Mount Rushmore of the legends that you told me. And I hit each of them in turn, and I've got different reactions for each of them. So I'm ready for this now. But you know, even just aside from individual moments, stuff like the fact that there is so much ludicrous fan service in the series that is this series puts Fairy Tail to shame in terms of.
I would be willing to go so far as to say we have never read a series with this much fan service. And keep in mind, we read a literal porno earlier this year. To put that in perspective, it's the latter parts of the series where it becomes truly egregious. And at that point, it earnestly feels like it's a battle manga that just has softcore pornography running in the background. A lot of the time, it has nothing to do with the plot, nothing at all to do like with what's happening, but there's always just some half-naked girl riding a lion or flying a plane with no pants on.
Why is she there?
And they're just constantly in a state of mid-orgasm or something. It's absurd.
Why is Stream Bikini Lion Girl in the story?
Why does she talk so much?
She doesn't do anything.
There are a lot of characters like that, where you're just like, I don't understand why you're here. You are superfluous to everything.
Why? I don't understand. I do understand. It's because O'Grady is a giant pervert who was way too goddamn inspired by Akamatsu Ken. Oh my God. Okay. This story, ran for 358 chapters plus a special epilogue finale chapter. So let's round up and say 360 chapters. 30 volumes across, what, like, nine? I think it was almost exactly 10 years.
About a decade. Almost, I think just a little under a decade.
So, when we say more fan service than any other series we've done, a lot of it comes down to volume. But at the same time, towards the end of the series, it is like a shameless example of fan service at least once a chapter.
Yeah.
That has nothing to do with anything that's going on.
You will...
Does not fit the tone of anything going on around it. There is going to be an intense flying through the sky with rollerblades, punching each other with wind balls fight going on, and then cut to someone watching it and they'll go, ah!
Yes, exactly.
For no reason.
None. It's not. She's not even like involved in the scene sometimes. It's almost like a cutaway. Like when in Oz, they used to occasionally just have the guy who played Michael from Lost, like sitting in a wheelchair, talk about the prison system for a little bit. Like you're just like, oh, I guess it's time to cut away to random 16-year-old girl orgasming.
You think, for those of you who, I'm sorry, I'm making another wrestling reference. Although this manga made a lot of wrestling references early on. So
yeah,
not the most inappropriate time to be doing it. There's this running gag that a lot of people who watch wrestling have made, which is that whenever a wrestler is watching a TV of the action going on in the ring, they never look natural while doing it, because a lot of it is framing the shot so that you can see the TV and you can see the wrestler. So it's never just, you know,
like, I see you, Nick. Mm-hmm.
Here's
you make
the
a
TV,
good point.
You know, right in front of me while I'm watching it. And it's never, I'm facing away from the camera and you can see the TV behind me. It's, I'm going to look at it like this.
Yeah.
Okay, the most unnatural way to watch TV, the over the shoulder. And so take that, except instead of doing this, I'm doing this, you know?
Yeah. I want to note, I purchased a lot of volumes of Air Gear, as you can see right here. And I, as you can see from the flags, I actually tabulated certain aspects that I wanted to keep in mind.
So, and that's the first volume.
This is the first volume. It doesn't,
before it gets weird.
It doesn't, yeah, this is the good part of Air Gear, if you can, well, quote unquote good. But it doesn't take 30 pages before you get this, which, if you can't see, is a two-page full spread of four girls naked in the shower. The one who I'm covering up, mind you, is 10. If we ever really hit on Fairy Tail for sexually exploiting Wendy, it has... I owe great nothing, or here are nothing but apologies, because this manga legitimately fetishizes loli porn at points. It is... And here's the thing.
Most of the characters that you see being fan serviceified are in middle school.
Yeah.
It's not like that 10-year-old is the exception. It's just that she doesn't have her double D cups didn't grow overnight yet, basically.
No. And you know what? I don't want to dig too much into this, because I do think there's a legitimate point to be made that sometimes the fan service of the series is actually, like, hilarious because of how stupid it is. But before I even get to that, I really just want to describe what I feel about Air Gear. Because
you're the one who had read this before. Yes. I had only seen the snippets that you had shown me up until we actually started reading the series.
Yes. So you brought up wrestling, and wrestling's a good way to kind of bring into this. So I like professional wrestling, and I know there are a lot of people out there who don't. They find it silly. It's a soap opera with body slams, et cetera, et cetera. But I would legitimately stress that I think it can be an amazing medium. It's not just, you know, silly predetermined stories and guys in tights. It's mythology. It's excitement. It's a spectacle. It's this perfectly wondrous combination of athleticism mixed with narrative and sometimes very simple, but sometimes very interesting stories with really unique characters that, when it's at its best, is absolutely enchanting and almost hypnotic, that you find yourself swelled into these stories of almost like modern day superheroes, of these people on screen. And when the crowd is into it, you just can't help but cheer. No matter how old you are, you're suddenly 8 years old again, cheering on your favorite hero. And I think wrestling can be an amazing medium. And
there's nothing quite like the feeling of my favorite's going to lose. They always have him lose. And all of a sudden, oh my god, he won, yes!
Yes. And I can have all that pride, and then you can show me a video of Hornswoggle, the Irish little person wrestler who had to pretend to be a leprechaun who hid under the ring to hit people.
He's not actually Irish, even.
Yeah.
He's Polish.
who hit people in the leg with a shillelagh and couldn't talk, and eventually turned out to be the illegitimate son of the owner of the company. And I'm like,
except not really.
Yeah. And then I'm like, oh, I'm embarrassed to be a wrestling fan because I forgot that there's that as well. That's what Air Gear is to manga. Because for as much as I love the medium of manga, Air Gear is all of the embarrassing parts of it just condensed into one series. Like, generally speaking, if one of my family members sees a manga I'm reading, I don't get embarrassed about it. And there are a couple that I'd be like, I think you'd actually enjoy this. But I would be legitimately mortified if, like, someone was looking over my shoulder while I was reading Air Gear, because I'm like, I don't have any defense. This is just garbage, most of it. There really is just it's an uncomfortable thing for it. And actually, I want to hear some of your thoughts, Nick.
This manga was stupid from the get-go.
Mm-hmm.
We're actually, like, not even actually talking what the series is about yet. So I'll kind of start going down that road as I give you my thoughts on the series, which are, it's goddamn terrible. But, I mean, it has its occasional moments here and there, but it is this really weird combination of lowest common denominator and attempting to be artsy as fuck at the same time. We'll hit all of it, but when this manga starts off, we're introduced to our main character, Iki. His full name is like Itsuki, but everyone calls him either Iki or Crow or piece of shit, you know? He is our hero. He is the most... He's introduced as being a tough fighter who's in a gang at the very start of the series. But then he gets beaten up by these really tough guys who wear these air tracks, which are these special inline skates that let them pull off ridiculous high-flying tricks. And somehow this makes them really hard to fight because... I don't know.
To be fair, the air treks are supposed to be, I guess, like, better roller skates. Essentially, like, motorized roller skates. Like, there's
They have batteries and engines, and somehow it's a combination of self-powered, but also how much power you put into the skate also defines the performance of it. There are attempts to explain how it works, which should never have been put in because they're the most bullshit. Every time that something is explained in Air Gear, it's bullshit and I skip it.
That's the way to do it, because one of your Mount Rushmore things probably is the bubbles that spin so fast they can cut steel.
That's the first head on Mount Rushmore. And I was actually okay with that moment because I was just like, all right, superpowers are being introduced. It's weird that she has the biggest ass in the series, and so she has to fire the bubbles backwards in order to bend over and look between her legs so you see her ass literally every time she attacks. But simply the concept of her bubbles are superpowered, and she shoots bubbles from her skates is like, I'll just accept it. I was fine. It was a little something that was like, no, okay. It's all right, I'll take it. The other heads were worse.
That was a moment that, looking back, isn't as bad as I thought it was at the time. Because
no.
I'm like, you know, all of the science in the series is pretty much poor shit, but it's not like that's the only, like, it's not like this is the only manga to be a victim of that. You know, Rurouni Kenshin's been butchering science for years before Oh Great got the chance to do it. So, yeah, you know what? Fine. But it is a point where it's just like, anytime science comes up, I just skip it. Because even if I wanted to sit there and pay attention to everything that's being described to me, I don't have the patience for it afterwards. Like, I don't have the time to devote to being angry about this, because there's a lot more to get through.
There is literally a moment late on in the series where one of the villains reveals that he has had his scapulas, his shoulder blades, removed because they're a relic of evolution where the wings used to come from, and humans don't actually need them, and so he has a freer range of movement with his arms. It's like he has four arms now instead of two. And it's like, no, that's the opposite of what would happen. He would not be able to use his arms at all if he did that. It's such bullshit.
Oh, man. This is going to be the challenge with Air Gear, because you brought that up, and I immediately want to move into talking about that fight.
Just skip to that point.
I'm like, let's just skip 90% of the manga, Nick, and start talking about how long that Nike fight was.
Okay. So, anyway, Icky gets in this fight with these roller skate gangsters. I think that they're called... They kind of drop the title early on. They're called Storm Riders.
I think that particular group's called the Skull Satyrs or something like that.
The Skull Satyrs, yeah. But they go away really quickly. But Storm Riders is the term used for people who use air tracks. And that's not something that honestly gets used a whole lot. It's just a term that disappears, I found.
It pops up every now and then, but there's so many other terms that then get thrown
replica
about.
And king.
Regalia. And yeah, there's a lot of stuff. Keeper.
Regalia, not replica, yeah. And tool toll toe.
Two toll two, I think. Yeah, it's. I call them the fucking fixie people. Fuck that name.
The naked fucking fixie people. So, Icky gets the shit beaten out of him by the Skull Satyrs. And not only does he get the shit beaten out of him, he gets something... I forget what it actually is. He gets something shoved up his ass.
A firecracker. He has a firecracker shoved up his ass. And he actually... He pisses himself after the guy almost kills him. Like, he basically, like, starts to, like...
He pisses himself in fear.
Yeah, like, he starts to give him, like, a tombstone from the sky. And, like, stops, like, you know, basically... That guy hits feet hit before Icky's neck would, but he pissed himself out of fear. And then they beat him up, take off his pants, shove a firecracker in his ass. And this is a detail I missed the first time going through. It also insinuates they rape his school students. Like his the female students that came to watch him and his friend skate. It very heavily insinuates that they get raped. And you're like,
because his two best friends bully him at school for a little while afterwards, and they explain themselves eventually, like, they've got, like, my sister, they've got, you know, my next-door neighbor, and they're gonna abuse them if we try and stand against them again, so that's why we're gonna, you know, put you down and keep you from going and confronting them like an idiot, so, yeah, we'll desecrate your desk and all this stuff. It's a very rapey series, just in general. Keep in mind, that scene with the four girls in the shower, those are Icky's foster family, his foster sisters. And Icky brazenly goes into the bathroom to peep at them.
Yeah.
At his foster family.
Here's the thing that you have to kind of grasp about this series. It's a very crude series. It's got a lot of very crude humor to it. And that is honestly, I think, one of the series' strengths at times, because it does lend itself to some amusing jokes. But more often than not, it comes off very uncomfortable and weird, because
you were doing a countdown through this week, like, you know, 7 days to Air Gear, 5 days to Air Gear, and sharing examples on Twitter of Icky taking all of his clothes off to take a shit on the sidewalk.
Yeah.
Like, for some reason.
It's just the style of series this thing is. Like, if you read this, you just have to accept that it's going to be very vulgar and crass at times. And one of the things that's really tough to kind of get over is that Icky and far worse extent Onigiri, one of the other members of Icky's team, are huge perverts. And they're shameless perverts at that. So, yeah, Icky all the time is peeping on, or just, like, playfully groping? I don't know is the term he'd use.
The sort of female lead in the series is Ringo, who is the foster sister that is closest to Icky in age. She is his childhood friend, which means she's the main love interest. And there are a couple of points where, yeah, he just grabs her boobs.
And I guess the reason I'd say playfully groping is he doesn't do that with everyone, per se. But the difference in that, though, is that Onigiri is a straight-up sexual assaulter. And that's his character. He's a hilarious sexual assaulter who rides after women so he can imagine them naked and, I don't know how much is insinuated to be real or not, basically lick their bodies and use his pheromones to basically force girls to be like, oh, freedom from clothing, whee!
It's really weird because he's a joke character through all, his whole thing is that, because he joins, he's one of the five main members of Ikki's air track team. And his gimmick is that he takes off one of his air tracks and puts it on his head and rides around upside down. The explanation being that way he can more easily look up girls' skirts as he's riding behind them.
This is one of the surprising things for me. This manga ran for 9 years. Onigiri does not ever gain a second dimension beyond pervert, and he's one of the five main members of Ikki's team. They try at the very end to be like, actually, he's not as perverted as he seems because he still prides an innocent smile more than anything. And at that point, you're like, horseshit! Fuck you! Don't pit this on me now! This fucker has had 300 plus chapters of chasing after girls and violating them in so many disgusting ways. You can't now be like, but in the end, he really just appreciates their beauty.
Honestly, like, I couldn't even get to Onigiri before I was done with this series. Like, early on, I'd settled on this because I was thinking to myself, well, I haven't hit all the weird stuff yet. It's gonna get weirder, it's gonna get stupider. But you know what? It doesn't matter. Ikki's a shit main protagonist. He is such an unlikable douchebag who everyone thinks is God. I fucking despise this whiny, perverted, crude, dumbass who thinks he is literally God's gift to humanity, piece of shit kid. And everyone around him, if he's not doing something to immediately piss them off, is like, he is going to be the next king of all riders. He is going to be the one who stands at the top of Trofeum Tower. He is the one who inspires us all. He's the one we all revolve around. And Ikki, he puts on this grand front, but really he cares about everyone. He tries so hard. No, he doesn't. He's an asshole. Fucking hate Ikki.
Upon rereading this series, I came out with a very different impression than I had the first time through. Initially I was like, huh, you know, the beginning wasn't even as good as I thought it was. I was like, man, the beginning's actually pretty bad. Like, I thought it was like a high point up until about around the point where they did the cube battles, but even before that I thought it kind of dropped off. This time through it was like, I guess only the fight with Buka is any good at all, and everything else is just complete shit. But the biggest takeaway I had is I was like, I fucking despise Ikki this time around. I couldn't believe how quickly I turned on this guy. And before when I was reading the series, I considered my turning point to be after that fight in the cube. I can't remember what exactly happens after that I had the big switch on. But that's where I started saying the series gets more and more shit. This time, I can tell you exactly where I turned on the series. And it's when Sora and Ikki are having the frisbee match against Rika and the other sisters. Because in that fight, Ikki is the biggest fuck on the planet. Essentially, to describe what's happening, Rika is the oldest sister in the house that he stays at. And essentially has been a big sister slash surrogate mother to her, to Ikki. He grew up without a family. He doesn't know who his family is. He's just been raised by these sisters. And Rika has been the oldest one who's taken the shoulder load of raising all of them. So she says, I don't want you to ride AT anymore. It's too dangerous.
You don't want to get caught up into that world. You don't want to see the things that I've seen, kid.
And at first, Ikki's like, no way, because this is my freedom. And I can get it from a quick moment there where it's like, okay, like he's found something that makes him free. He doesn't want to have that taken away just from someone else worried about safety. But then Rika starts to explain and goes into very vivid detail about how Sora was once like him until his chase for power ended up with him getting crippled by another team that wanted to stop him, and how horrible it was because she loved him and she didn't want to see another person she loved fall that way. And Icky's responses, and she's kicking his ass in this contest because it's basically a match to decide whether or not he has to give up air tricks. She's kicking his ass, and Icky's responses is to cry like a fucking bitch because his dreams are going to get shattered. And at that point, I was like, fuck you, dude. This whole series is predicated on this idea of air tricks being the place to be free and to skate and to live completely without any restrictions, even from gravity. Gravity can't even have any control over you. And Icky has not lived even the slightest life of any circumstance that makes me wish and hope that he gets this life of freedom that he wants, because he has grown up in a perfectly nice family. All of these girls consider him family, and his response to one of them having legitimate concerns about his safety because air tracks are actually a world that has gangsters and fucking murder in it from the first volume, not even the crazy shit later on where there's WMD roller skates. His response is to cry like a child because he's losing, which isn't exactly clear if he's doing it because he's that much of a bitch or if he's that disgustingly manipulative that he's using it to lower his big sister's guard enough to slightly shift momentum in their fight. E is a fucking dickhead.
Yeah. That singular moment really sums it up perfectly well. Because it's so hard to pinpoint a single moment for me for a lot of this, because so much of the series feels the exact same, which is Icky acting like a dickbag until it's time for him to look cool. And so, like, his leather jacket flows out behind him, the wind is in his hair, and he says a line that is supposed to come across as cool. Like, you know, it doesn't matter because I'm really the best, and I'm the one who's going to stand at the top and grasp freedom and soar through the sky. And so everyone just follow behind me because I'm going to win. And so you have no reason to be confident. You don't earn anything that happens to you in this series. You're just bullshit just because. The thing that annoyed me just as much as Icky is the way that everything relates to the sky and flying and the wind and freedom and soaring and birds and cages and all the people that I've met are feathers, and individual feathers can't do anything, but all the feathers together form a wing, and those wings will allow me to soar above all those cages in the world, allow me to rip through all the chains that bind me down to the earth, and I will fly towards the ultimate freedom and stand at the top of the world. Now repeat that 360 times, and you've got a full series on your hand.
Like, people like to comment on the fact that when it comes to Kingdom Hearts, like, the terms darkness and heartless and all that are repeated ad nauseum. Air Gear far surpasses that if you just boil it down to the words wings, freedom, sky, flying, soar, cage, and wind, essentially. Like, if you just break it down to, like, those words, it would far surpass it, because everything in this series is prose and symbolism to that extent. But it's something that very quickly loses its meaning, because it never gets more intricate than that. It just reiterates it in different ways, or more obtuse manners, essentially. The best way to describe it, this is a series, I think, I read as a teenager, and I think a lot of people that I've seen read it probably were teenagers too that enjoyed it, because I feel like that's the age where you'd enjoy this sort of thing, because you're like, wow, this is deep. I do want freedom. But then when you get to be an adult, and I'm sitting here and I'm like, I have bills to pay. Fuck all of you and you're flying. Like, all right. It's not as though I'm completely alien to the concept of what they're talking about. When I go running, there's a thing called the runner's high, which is a point where you've been running so much, the endorphins kick in, and you are filled with this kind of sense of tranquility and enjoyment that helps you just completely forget all the suffering. It's what people chase after kind of at times. You want to hit that point. where you stop caring about the suffering actually becomes part of the enjoyment. That sense of freedom that comes with it, that thing that makes you feel alive. And I can understand how skating through the airs with roller skates does make you feel that way. Because there are actually scenes, and this is one of Oakreed's legitimate...
Early on, there's a Butcha.
Yes.
He's introduced as one of Icky's first enemies. And he's this really weird-looking guy. He seems to be obese at first glance, but it turns out he's just a really hefty dude. He's got dark skin, and he looks weird, so people have looked down him and bullied him for being such a weird-looking big guy his whole life. And he's got all this weight holding him down to the earth. And he has this moment during the fight with Icky where you get this insight about him, where he feels as though when he's using air tracks that he's completely weightless, that he can fly through the sky like he doesn't weigh a single thing. And it's this great sense of freedom. Like, it doesn't matter what he looks like or was born as.
Yeah,
it never gets as good as that again.
Yeah. The sense that ATs make it possible for anyone to fly, no matter who they are. Like, that's a cool thing. And I think my favorite moment in the series is a scene. I think it's after they see the fight that Agito gets introduced in. Mm-hmm. And all of them are escaping, and there's like a big two-page spread of all the characters leaping into the sky.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I'm like, I can get invested in this. I can get this. It's when everything else in the series becomes about fucking magic roller skates and battles. Battles which I would like to note, Icky noted he had no interest in originally. He did not care about.
He just wanted to have fun.
He just wanted.
Why does he do that?
He just wanted to have fun with his friends, and then eventually the only thing in his mind is how to fucking win more roller skate battles. But that's the thing, like, when it's just about skating through the air and having fun, and I can even see the athletic contest still having that same feeling, it works. It's when it becomes straight up battle series that all the shit about flying loses all meaning, because they're not flying anymore. They're just fucking spinning around and crazy effects happen. It's like
the bending in The Last Airbender.
I have been thinking on my thoughts on this series for a while, and every time my thoughts start off less negative than I expect them to, because overall, I didn't hate this series as much as I thought I was going to upon rereading it.
It's not worth hating.
But as I start talking about it more and talking about the things I hate, I get fucking caught into this. It just spirals, and my hate and passion for the series that just like grow 10 times. I'm like the Grinch. Like, it's a night before Christmas, and my hate's just grown 3 times. There are a lot of... Alright, I'm trying to think where we should even go from here.
Why don't we start off by talking a little bit about, like, the original kind of core characters we have. Because we've talked about Icky, mm-hmm. and how we hate him.
We've already said everything that needs to be said about Onigiri as well.
Pretty much. Ringo, the problem when talking about any female character in Air Gear is that in about the last third, or maybe even the last half of the story, they are pretty much only there for fan service. Some of them do other things, but they're there for fan service. Because Ringo is involved in the final fight. In this big thing where, I don't give a fuck, spoilers, Rika has been brainwashed and is pregnant with the main villain's child, and she's being controlled by some sort of heretofore unestablished robo insect that has laced its way into her spine in order to control her.
I hate this series so much. It's the series about roller skates. It's about fucking roller skating, and there's goddamn spine invading parasites in it. Ugh.
Sorry. Hang on. Okay. So, anyway. So Ringu is forced to fight against her sister. Her almost motherly sister, who's also pregnant with her nephew or niece. And she's got to fight her, and she's told, like, oh, if she tries to disable the ATs, the regalia that she's using, then it will kill her, and it will kill the child. So this should be this big emotional moment. And so in order to combat this, Ringo unlocks, like, the true form of the weapons that she's using, which, you know, causes her to go through this full body transformation where the skates become a full outfit on her. The true form of the Thorn Regalia or whatever. And so she's got these kind of robotic vines twisting around her body. But some of them kind of look like, you know, like bondage a bit. And then Rika just kind of stops and looks at her because one of them is going very obviously just around her crotch. And Rika goes, it's not real underwear, so I don't feel embarrassed about it.
What? What does that mean? This was a serious scene. Why did you say that?
And Rika has a big, but there's no way of other way of looking at it. Clearly under. But the brainwashed, fighting your own sister, pregnant with child, who you don't want to hurt. Why? That's how I sum up almost every single female character in the story beyond a certain point. Some of them started off as actually being kind of interesting. And there are some things here and there where it's like, oh, I could get into that, honestly. They introduced this concept, which is really just a lazy excuse for more fan service, called tuning. You form a partnership with someone in order to unlock the true potential of your air tracks. It's stupid to begin with. But I like the idea of, by forming a strong, close connection with somebody, that allows you to achieve your full potential. But mostly it's just...
It makes sense on a simple level, because they're essentially mechanics for air tracks, which, as we've come to find out, are the only important thing in this universe. Essentially, air tracks become the most important thing in the entire world, which is weird, because... At the start of the series, they were just marketed
just
as
underground skates.
They were just marketed as something businessmen used to get places. It would be like if halfway through Toriko, all of a sudden food now was the most important thing in the world. Like, it's like, how did this? All right. But like, they're mechanics for your skates. And it would make sense that certain people, like specializing with you, can get the best output out of it. They know how to tweak everything. They know how to mod it just for you. They just.
What's that? Noyomono. Is this female character who just kind of hangs out with Iki's team for a bit. But she ends up developing this crush on Agito, one of the strongest members, pretty much the strongest member of the team up until Iki becomes broken. And she just kind of holds this silent crush for him, and she ends up getting caught up in this fight that he's having. And during the course of the fight, she realizes that she has to be the one to be his tuner. She's the only one who actually has a close enough bond with him that she can actually do it. And on a very surface level, I can get into that. It's like, okay, yeah, this is a way to, you know, have relationships or friendships or romance, which pretty much every single tuner, writer relationship has romantic overtones to it. I can't really think of a single one where the tuner doesn't want to bone the fuck out of the writer.
Yeah.
But I like the idea of it. The thing is, though, I don't know if you want to take this or me. How do you tune with someone, Chris?
Well, it's a very precise thing, which makes sense. I mean, again, think about like a mechanic. When you stop at a pit stop in NASCAR, the guys there had to be extremely quick and very precise. So obviously with that precision comes a very high attention to even the smallest amount of time, milliseconds, and being able to count that all internally with no assistance. Of course, sound is also very difficult to hear when you're wearing all these suffocating clothes. So you take all of them off and put on some sort of quasi full body naked suit that isn't really even a suit. They're just naked, but they're not. But it's as close as Ogre can get since he's not actually allowed to draw full nudity in his series. And with that, you're able to better harness your ability to attune to them. Of course, to fully attune with them, you need to fuck them. That's just how it works.
You need to touch as much of their body skin as possible in order to, so that you can tune yourself to the rhythm of their heartbeat.
And I would like to note,
heaven forbid you get a stethoscope, you know. And
that wouldn't work.
No.
And I would like to note that
you gotta match that biorhythm.
Yeah. With your chest against mine. And I would like to note that one line is directly lifted from the series because Ninomiya, or whatever her name is, Ninoyomiya, whatever her fuck, the other track girl.
No Yamano.
She actually has a point in the middle.
No, that's the sisters. My mistake. Go ahead.
Yeah. But there's
Nakayama.
So there's a point during a battle where she's trying to fix Agito's skills. And she's like, I can't hear with all these clothes on. And she literally just rips off her clothes so she can work on his skates better. And you're like, okay, sure. What? All those clothes were just totally obscuring your vision, your hearing. I get it. Of course. That's when the fan service is kind of funny, because you just have to sit there and you're like, you just wanted an excuse. You couldn't think of one, so you just went with this.
And you've got all these scenes of these girls in these very inappropriate skin tight, to the point that they actually conform around their nipples.
Yes.
Outfits. Just in these freaking weird mechanical get-up so that they're all hooked up together to work on one thing, and they're all listening to music together while they're all naked because somehow singing a song together lets them tune.
Tool Toe is the most weird fucking organization. They're almost predominantly all women who has said dress up in like these weird fucking see-through bodysuits. Spend their time fixing things while also being
in a junkyard.
In a junkyard / cathedral, because they're also heavily Catholic. They literally spend their days fixing things while reciting the Our Father. And you're just like, what is this organization? This is so weird!
And they're supposed to be a neutral party, but each of them dedicate their lives to individual writers. So.
Which seems like there really can't be neutrality in there when the individual writers all have allegiances. And their writer, because there's a thing in the series of the kings, or the keepers in the English translation, where those are essentially the leaders of certain roads. Basically, at first, it's just the idea of how you ride, like Icky is the wind king because he rides on the air itself, and Kazu could be the flame king because he skates so fast, he leaves flames behind. Later on, it's just horseshit battle manga powers. Like, I don't understand how you'd be the thunder king out of riding. You're like, I, of course, ride all the time with my giant wires of firing electricity jutting out in all directions.
Chris, there's a maid in this series who doesn't wear a skirt, so she's just flashing her panties constantly, whose air tracks turn into a giant cannon. Let's not get caught up on how is he the Thunder Road.
Yeah. And you have those, everybody has their roads. Then tool-toed fucking fixie people have their own leader, the Pledge Queen, who rides the Ring Road, which to this day I still don't understand what the fucking road is. They don't do...
She doesn't use air tracks.
Karuru admits, like, I don't ride. I don't skate. I don't do this. Like, I just have my own thing. I'm like, this entire organization is fucking bonkers, and you annoy me so much. Everything you do is related to skates.
Now that you've talked about Karuru, let's talk about Icky's harem for some reason. Okay. You got Ringo. Okay. Akito has a split personality disorder. His main split personality is Akito, who is gay, kind of, and just sleeps in the same bed as Icky and wakes him up with kisses for a joke. And he's only gay up until halfway through the series when Akito gets a female love interest, and they kind of just forget that Akito is gay in order to allow for Nakayama to get naked and crawl upon him. Then you've got Simka, who is the woman who basically draws Ikki into the world of air track battles. Simka is at first introduced as being a very proficient rider who is part of Genesis, essentially the top of the AT world. What she ends up becoming is Miss Fan Service, then Miss Wheelchair Fan Service, then Miss No Longer in a Wheelchair, Sits on Your Face and Mocks You for It Fan Service.
I came out of the series not able to determine which character I actually hated most between Onigiri, Ikki, and Simka. Because Simka is fucking infuriating. She exists just to be this amalgamous blob of fan service and faux mystery. Because nothing she says is ever direct. It's always just misleading or cryptic bullshit. She's never forthright with her plans. She half the time is speaking in poetry or songs because that's just what fits the mood. And she's basically a petulant child grown up. Yeah. Oh, also, she has some of the most egregious fan service in this.
That's her sitting on a guy's head in order to punish him while teasing him and saying that that he is her type and saying, come to mama. While she is dressed in only a jacket, which someone kindly lent her because she had been tossed around as a weapon while naked during one of the main battles in the climax. Literally, she was used as a club while she was naked.
That was one of my favorite parts of the series. I want to note that battle with Nike took so fucking long, but I love
so many false finishes. He kicked out of the Super AA, Chris.
I love though that they like he looked like he was defeated, and they started going to this thing like Nike wasn't really the victim or wasn't really the villain here. He was just another victim of Sora's plans. And then he gets
I'm
up
still here.
And he's the most unrepentant dickhead possible, who literally just starts tossing this crippled chick around like a weapon. I'm like, oh, dude. You're gonna go out, but you are going out like a boss. You did not go out like a bitch.
Oh, Nike, you're such a better villain than Sora is. And he's your twin. He's the worst twin.
Now, technically you're both Sora, just for...
You're both named Sora because you were both experiment numbers and you both took the name of Sora, but then they were finally like, no, this is confusing. You'll be Nike.
It doesn't make sense. They picked their own names. No one forced Sora on both of them. And he still gets a different name later on. So why are they both called Sora? It doesn't even play into the plot. It's not like someone's like, Sora Samaguchi did this to me. No one does that. They're just both called Sora for some reason until the other guy's like, I'm also Nike. And boom. Why not just call him Nike? They made their own names.
I lost my train of thought. Ikki's hair. The third and final girl to be part of the love square is Karuru, the head of the most proficient of all the tuners, who just whips out giant rows of wrenches and screws in order to prepare tuning in midair while Ikki is falling helplessly through the sky while Karuru is thinking about 9/11. The second head on Chris's Mount Rushmore of stupid moments, which was also not nearly as bad as you made it seem like, because it comes up because Ringo is making the point of air tracks were not originally meant to be used as weapons, but tools can be used for different purposes than what their designers and inventors originally intended them to. For example, when the terrorists at 9/11 used box cutters to take control of the airplanes and cause those tragedies. But then when you kind of remove the setup for that, when Kuru is flying through the sky and you just kind of have to accept that she's heard Ringo's whole explanation of this, which I guess she explained in vivid detail, Then she's just like, yes, I do kind of see Ringo's point. Flying through the air trying to catch Ikki, suddenly you just see the buildings falling on 9/11.
That's the thing. Like, rereading, I'm like, yes, it does make more sense. The thing that's weird is the initial thing you're talking about, that description Ringo gives, is in a chapter in and of itself. She gives that description. They show, like, a box cutter. They show the shots of 9/11. The chapter after that has Kururu diving into the water because Ikki has taken too hard of a shot and he's falling. And she basically goes in after him. Midway through that, they just interject one panel of 9/11. And you're like, that's weird. That would have been more appropriate last chapter. But if you dig deeper into it, it's still really stupid. Because Ringo's whole point about what she's talking about at that point is that her team's goal is to destroy all the regalia. That's their goal. These weapons are too dangerous. Ikki, fucking, for whatever reason, is like, no. I want to be the Air King. I want to be the best. Despite the fact that the star of the series, he was just like, fuck all this king bullshit. I just want to fly with my friends. At this point, he's like, you're wrong, Ringo. How dare you? And you're like, no, she has a valid point. This is much, much more dangerous than fucking box cutters. These are literal weapons of mass destruction.
These things shoot fire, and you can cause air vacuums with them to create hurricanes.
Those are the good ones. Those are the ones you could see maybe being helpful to society. There are some that just flat out dangerous, like the bubble one that shoots bubbles that explode and kill people.
One of them is called the Fang Redalia. It does nothing but rend flesh from bone.
It just mutilates people. She has a very valid reason and a good point in wanting these to all be destroyed.
Thank God Agito's a good guy almost from the beginning, or he would have murdered people. He was a child soldier to begin with. Who knows how many people he killed in AT battles.
And that's another thing that's really fucked up about this series. So Agito, I just want to talk about him real quick. He's actually, despite being an important character in the series, not much to say about him. I mean, his early plot is that he was essentially kept in a cage and used as a weapon. Ikki helps him find freedom. It's one of the times freedom actually works in the series, because Agito actually has a tough life. He joins up with Ikki's team, but because of the way he is, he's never really fully committed to them for a while. He mostly stands off to the side and is like, fuck you guys, fucking shit, you're all fucking garbage.
He curses a lot.
Yeah. Until eventually he starts getting enamored with the team and becomes a full member. He has a brother. His brother is the leader of the AT police team. Which,
oh my god, this backstory.
It comes at the very end of the fucking series. But I'm not going to go through all of this because it's way too complicated and involves a third split personality inside of fucking Agito that's actually his mother, and it's implied that he gives birth to himself at the end of the series again. I can't do it. But in the flashback, it's revealed that Kaito, what we thought was Agito's brother, is in fact his dad. And I would like to stress, Kaito has kept Agito in a cage, essentially for the entire time he's known him, solely to release him. By the way, Agito, when he was younger, was a pacifist. It was a violent personality that was born from him because he was forced to kill people as the Fang King. He did all that, and you're like, wow, Kaito's a real shit. But don't worry, his explanation is that he was doing it because he didn't want him to escape like his first love did. And you're like, that's fucked up. You're a really fucking awful dad. Like,
I'm going
maybe
to keep
the worst.
I lost the love of my life, whom I tried tirelessly to keep away from the world of air tracks. And I'm going to make up for my failures by putting my son with her directly into the world of battles with air tracks.
I hate what these things have done, but I'll make my son the most homicidal maniac of that community. Like, what? Why at this point did you were slightly almost kind of redeeming him just as the brother figure who was too far before but is now starting to soften and realize he was too extreme in his methods? Why did you have to go back and explain, like, no, he did it all because of love? Like, this was all love. This was good intentions, And it's not even really that bad when you think about it, because there was so much love to it. You're like, no, you're an asshole.
Hey, but I got to draw Rule 63 Akito, right?
Oh, man.
So, Karu is my least favorite character in the series, though.
Oh, okay.
Because all of the stuff, all the pretension in the series is, like, embodied in her. Everyone can only talk about flying. She can only talk about skates. And one of the moments, I don't know if this was actually in your Mount Rushmore. No, the other, okay. Let's talk about one moment, and then let's talk about the third moment in your Mount Rushmore.
Okay.
There is a moment where, out of fucking nowhere, see, Karu is established to seemingly only understand things and how they relate to air tracks, because she is intimately capable of, you know, without a second thought, perfectly tuning something. You know, I guess it's been her life's work to this point to be get this good. She, I don't know. I tune so much of Tool Toto out. I have no idea. But there's a bit where during the battle that Kogurasu Maru, which is Iki's team, is having, he's like, there are so many parts that together make an air track, and this team is the same. Bucha-san plays the part of the damper. Akito-san is the wheels, and Kazu-san is the lubricating oil. Onigiri-san is the transmission, and Emily-san is a situation-dependent optional part. And of course...
she fucking calls her interchangeable! Like,
she's that part that is non-essential to the skate that you might throw in there if you gotta go on.
She's the appendix of this team. You don't need it, but it's kind of nice to have it around, you know. If I were Emily, course, I'd be like, fuck you, bitch!
And of course, Iki-kun is the engine that drives everybody forward. And it's like, okay, you explain why Iki is the engine. You did not do anything whatsoever to explain why anyone is anything else. You just named parts on a roller skate with car parts in it and said, you're that one, you're that one, and didn't explain why. You're not even explaining your symbolism now anymore. At least when you're talking about all the people in the world are a feather that will create my wings that will allow me to soar through the sky and allow me to escape all the chains that hold me down to this heavy earth and allow me to fly towards the ultimate freedom. At least all that stuff is fucking obvious, and you don't need to explain every single goddamn part of your symbolism. What's a damper? You're the lubricating oil.
I'd be like, what? Is that suggestive? Are you calling me lube?
And if it is supposed to be suggestive, why isn't Onigiri the lube?
Yeah, that would actually kind of work.
Why isn't Kazu something that has to do with ignition?
Or speed, yeah, his whole thing.
I guess lubricating oil would be like lube on the wheels? I don't fucking know. But then this all builds towards the pièce de résistance with all of O-Grade's pretentious fucking bullshit, which is... So that big fight that Iki had with his sisters, he was teaming up with Sora, the person that Rika introduced as her love interest, this person that she got close to in the AT world, the person who, like Iki, set his sights on achieving the pinnacle of the AT world, of being the king. And then he was crippled. And so at this point in the series, he's in a wheelchair. He can still do some tricks because he was such a proficient rider that he can still do some things. He can, like, emanate fucking blasts of air from his palms somehow. And so he uses that to glide around on his wheelchair during this fight. And he's actually better than Iki is at this point. And so Iki sets him as his goal. He's like his older brother figure. Despite the fact he was, like, never noted before in the series, I guess he has this close relationship with him now. Tangent. There's a football mini arc in this story where Iki has doubts about what he's doing. So he goes to see a senpai who's with this air track football league, who apparently is someone that Iki has a close bond with, but he has never shown up since and never shows up again.
Yeah. It was like, because they even tried to hint that this was like, it's like a mysterious figure for Icky. Because there's like one shot of like a silhouette figure that Icky looks up to. And that's apparently the guy who, as you said, shows up in this one scene, is referenced at one point later on as the team's still needing help, and then never brought up again.
Like, Icky talks to, I think he talks to Sora about, yeah, at one point I was going, I think, yeah, whatever, senpai, and I got to see him. And then that's it. Like, just 20 chapters later, he is a distant memory. So I have no idea why this wasn't the same character. Maybe he just felt like putting him in a wheelchair. I don't know. Anyway, so Sora's in a wheelchair, and he is this, he's a mentor to Icky, and also a warning to him. And then it turns out that Sora is actually the main villain of the series, and that everything that he's been doing has been so that he can continue his goal to become the Sky King. And Icky was in fact a puppet. Icky had thought this whole time that Air Trax had allowed him to find his own way and achieve freedom, when actually he was dancing on puppet strings. He had been in a cage this whole time. He thought he was free, but really he was a slave. And Icky has a complete breakdown over this. Everything in his life seemingly has been a lie. He has, you know, this big, you know, Cloud Strife moment where he's like, no, you were wrong. All that you've been working for, you've actually just been working for the enemy. And he breaks down and he cries and he slumps down, and Kuru embraces him. And she says, if only there were a screw that could mend this sorrow. Out of fucking nowhere, in the most emotional, everything has changed moment of the series, she just talks about, like, I don't know how humans work. I can only fix skates. If only I could screw up this damage as I would with a skate. If only, with a screw.
If only I could put a screw in and bad things would stop happening. In a full
plug
page,
it up like the little boy and the dam.
Yeah. In a full page spread. It's not like this is a small, like a joke. This isn't a joke. This, like, it's not a line that's supposed to be taken as like, haha, Karuru can't relate to people. It's meant to be like, oh, she really, really cares about Icky, and she's so sad that she feels powerless in this moment. And you're like, what? Like, if I was Killick in the room at the time, I'd be like, what the fuck are you talking about? Like, I want to be the bystander in the world of Air Gear, to just be around all this stupid fucking dialogue, because it
be like the sassy gay friend in the series.
I'm Aeon Clock then.
Aeon Clock is one of my favorite characters in this story because he doesn't take shit from anybody.
There's so many moments of just awful, corny dialogue. There's a line far later on in the series where Killick, who's like essentially like the super straight-laced professional, like high powerful member of Sleeping Forest, who for some reason evaluates people on a point scale, is
he was betrayed by Sora in the beginning, and he's the one who's kind of he's the one who's leading the main resistance group against the villain.
Yes.
And yeah, he grades people.
Yeah. So he's in his office and he's kind of talking about like, hey, you know, I know a lot of us are doing this attack, but it's very possible not all of us will return, and there's no way we can change that plan. And one of the other members of Sleeping Forest is like, man, you don't bat an eye at this thing. I bet all you think about is air checks. I bet even your brain is made out of air checks. Not even the stupid line there. That's the line that happens. Then someone else watching Killick as he puts a book away is like, your mind is made out of air checks, but I guess your heart is different. And you're like, I want to be the dude who's like, gay. Like, it's just such a stupid line. Like, I guess your heart isn't made out of air tricks. I'm like, of course fucking not. It's not a roller skate. Like, what does that mean?
These wheels sticking out of his chest.
Like, I don't know what you thought, oh great. It's not that interesting of symbolism. Not everything can be roller skates. It would work. Like, here's the thing. This series has humor at times at its own expense. But in moments like this, it never feels like it's in on the joke. It's not like the world of Toriko, where you get the sense that Shimi Burkuro is aware of how silly everything is. When he makes Acacia's full, or Midora's full course menu, all of the love Froge gave him. Or when they say things like, I'm on a diet, as like a badass, like chapter ending line. You get the sense Shimi Burkuro is aware of that, and it's a parody. You don't get that from this series. You sometimes have to think, I have to imagine Oh Great has some cognitive awareness that this is lame, but it doesn't show, because everything is portrayed as though this is fucking legit seriousness. Pay
this
attention.
This is the greatest thing ever put yes. to paper.
That every time someone has one of these deep introspection about hearts and ATs and freedom, that people would just be sitting there at the page afterwards like, man, a modern day poet of our times.
Maybe they don't feel that way, but then they're just like, oh, Simca's sure showing a lot of cleavage in that wheelchair that's torture.
Just read porn! He drew some! He drew porn! If you like his art, just read the porn he drew!
Oh my god. Let's talk about my favorite characters and the ones that escape with the least dignity in this series, as if to punish me for having people that I like in that. Kazu and Emily.
Oh.
Kazu is Ikki's best friend in the series. At first, he, you know, has no interest in air tracks, but as Ikki gets involved in it, he gets drawn more and more into the world, and so he decides that, hey, he might as well get good at it. And he ends up developing a specialty. He's the speedmaster of the group when it comes to just straight up who can just dash along the road the fastest. He's your guy. He gets compared to a stealth fighter jet. He's so fast, like he disappears. And over time, despite the fact that he's actually overall one of the weaker members of the team at first, people start to see potential in him. The previous Flame King sees that he's got a greater passion than anyone else. And so he thinks that he can have the passion to create flames. And so he says, I'm choosing him as my eventual successor. He could be the next Flame King. He's a human being who doubts himself and seems the most normal out of Ikki's group, honestly, out of the main core of people, because he has doubts about himself. He reacts to things and he's usually like the straight man. He has breakdowns. There's a fight where the bubble girl is introduced, where he thinks to himself, because Kogarasumaru has like a helper on their team who is this representative from a much better team, and he's not around. So Kazu just tells the other guys who are the weaker members of the team, guys, let's just not even bother helping. She'll just take care of everything. You know, what's the point? If we try and help, then we're just going to get in the way because we're so weak. We're like ants compared to them. And of course, they're like, no, we got to do our part to help, even if it's the smallest difference. And by the end of the fight, he has executed this really complicated trick that he saw the Flame King use, and he summons flame from his wheels by scorching them against the ground, and the heat rising from the flames causes a girl who's falling to have her fall cushioned so she doesn't fall to her death, and he finds the will to fight again. And then the series won't stop belittling him. I got so frustrated. I was like, come on. Come on. Stop. No, stop. Let him have some dignity. No. Why did he join an orgy cult? Why?
That's the most random part of the series.
It's so fucking stupid. He gets mentally broken and at his lowest point is drawn into a cult, which has 100 strong orgies led by a guy in this ornate demonic suit for some reason who leads them all. And Ikki and company immediately discover he's joined the cult. Ikki uses, I think, Aeon Clock's connections to infiltrate the gang, wear the demon suit, and lead this faux ritual in an attempt to have Kazu get his confidence back by fighting. But really, Ikki is just using it as an excuse to grope all the naked women in the audience. And What was the point of this?
If it helps you at all, Nick, you could have been a big fan of Bucha like I was. In which case,
cool at first.
I think he's still legitimately the best character in the series.
He probably is!
Because he actually has, like, a really strong arc all the way through. It just really is disappointing because he's basically the second...
He's Chad.
Yeah, he is. He's introduced as basically the second, like, strongest member of the team, especially the second most experienced writer on the team, because he was one of the first opponents Icky went against. And he knows about air tracks.
He ruled the school for a time.
And he's this huge powerhouse. He's basically looks like this big fat guy, but by pulling the blood in his stomach into his arms, again, don't think of the science, he gets really muscular. And he's symbolized by a tank, and he actually has, like, trank tread roller skates. Like, it's so cool. And he's this awesome character at first. Every battle after that, he loses. Every fucking... He eventually does win some, but the cube battle, he loses. The dash battle, he loses. He loses a couple miscellaneous battles at the time where Icky can't participate.
He loses against an office full of workers and is warped out of the fight. Like, he tries to take one of them out, and one of them counters with this super punching thing, and he's put on the bench for the rest of the fight. And he's being told by everyone, you have a strong body, but whenever things get hard for you, you just give up.
Which is like, alright, but they actually do play into that. They start playing into the idea that it's his negativity that's causing him to fail, because he sees these geniuses like Icky and Agito, and even Kazu, who has now been recognized as the successor to the Flame Road. And he starts getting worried because he won't be able to catch up with them, and that causes him to think negatively, and that's what causes him to lose. So he goes on this big enlightenment journey thanks to the fucking omnipresent fucking Spitfire AI that exists to tell everybody what to do after his death.
I have pre-programmed responses and am able to react in real time as your data changes.
I'm going to make Russell Crowe's character in Man of Steel look worthless and limited with the amount of shit I've apparently programmed in. Everything you guys considered up until the final matchups in the series against opponents we didn't quite know about at that point, I will tell you how to fight them. He gets basically the instruction to meditate and find enlightenment. And that's what happens. And he does have one fight at the end of the series where he achieves enlightenment, basically reveals a new power, and defeats one of the stronger members, or one of the stronger opponents that the series had built up. And actually what's kind of a cool fight, because there's a lot of back and forths and up and downs, and it feels like he earns his victory. But that's 350 chapters down the line, basically. That fight with Bucha is volumes 2 and 3. He doesn't really get to shine through the rest of that series. All of the middle is him just getting the shit kicked out of him, to the point where the only person on the team he's better than is the fucking pervert who's only good when he's fighting women because they're afraid of him.
It's really weird because in a different series, Onigiri would have gotten a ridiculously badass moment at the end. Like, if it had been any other series, the moment where, because he goes up against essentially the second strongest enemy that they ever have to face, Nike. And they say Onigiri is completely worthless unless he's going up against women. In which case, his battle level, because of course power level is going to introduce in this manga, his battle level skyrockets. And so they're in this really dire situation where they've got to save Simca, who's being held hostage. And so he's just like, I must imagine. I have to imagine that my opponent isn't this horrifying demonic muscle freak. Instead, I'll imagine that he's a half-naked girl who's come to my room to play. And instead of using his smell to freak Nike out, he just starts wailing on him, just punching and kicking him and kicking his ass. And it's like, wow, if you hadn't been so ridiculously creepy for 340 chapters up to this point, I think that you were actually kind of cool right here.
It's weird because they actually joke about it a lot that he's worthless. Like in the fight on the with the bubble girl, he gets eliminated because he tries to jump to Emily's platform and she's like, get the fuck away, and kicks him off and eliminates him from the contest while knocking someone else off. And she's like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. They're like, no, you removed our biggest liability and knocked someone off at the time. And the same thing happens during the plane fight. Like, he gets eliminated really early on. And they're like, well, that was to be expected. He sucks.
Now he's getting such a low power level. Come on. Yeah.
Mm. Now, the thing always is that, like, somehow he just slightly affected the battle in some way with his fucking smell road bullshit. Like, some woman in the fight gets conditioned slightly off of the after effects. But it's always treated as a joke that he's worthless. Like, no one treats him with respect. And again, his character is defined entirely around being perverted. Like, they don't even hit upon him really being friends with Iggy so much. Like, that's actually a big part with Kazu. Like, he wants to get better because he's always been chasing after Iggy. And he
because
wants
Iggy
to
was
be
a
like
little
him.
Prick to him when they were kids. Seriously. Even in flashbacks where Iggy's supposed to have had a tremendous inspirational effect on people, they established that Iggy and Kazu essentially played tag when they were kids. And Iggy was constantly torturing Kazu and, like, stealing his shoes and putting mud and worms in them. And so Kazu would have to run without wearing shoes and he would get his feet beaten up. And Iggy eventually would confide in someone who's like, the reason why I do that is because eventually he's just going to get faster than me and I'm never going to catch him. That's being an awful friend.
It's like, that's a real shit thing to do.
You shitty little kid who will become a shitty little teenager. Fuck you. But the way that Kazu sees it is that he was always chasing after Iggy. He's always been looking at Icky's back while advancing forward, and so he set Iggy as his goal, and he uses that as something, you know, he sees Iggy continuing to get better. Barry's like, I've got to keep up, I've got to keep going and getting better if I'm ever going to catch up with him or surpass him. And he eventually had, honestly, like, his segment of the Nikkei battle, if you ignore all the false finishes, because he's the one who eventually finally finished him off after he's fought, like, three other people. He has a pretty satisfactory conclusion because he's been, you know, this guy who's had to be protected through the whole story, who hasn't lived up to all of his potential. You've seen flashes of brilliance from him. And so eventually he's finally, like, after three different people have seemingly been killed and Nikkei still hasn't gone down, he's like, what am I doing? These people have sacrificed themselves for me and I'm still not doing anything. I'm still not strong enough. I have to, for their sake, for the sake of the sacrifices they made, I've got to finish this and stop him. And he finally does. He beats one of the strongest characters in the series with other people's help. And it's the moment where you actually believe the whole, every person, every memory that I've made with people is a feather, and those feathers form a wing to allow me to fly. Experiences with people pile up and allow him to get to finally defeat him. He uses the Flame Regalia for real for the first time, and he wins the fight. Good for you, Kazu.
It's a cool moment, slightly hurt by the fact that the Flame Regalia's power is sort of horseshit, where it's like, yes, the power of flames. Also, you can connect with every rider who's ever existed in all time and use their tricks at once as well, because flames are the beginning and open the door for everything. And all
and the
paths.
Real reason that he wins is also the fact that people were watching the fight because it's being broadcast and they were chatting about it.
And they were sending Omnimon messages to clog up his power. Like, no!
Oh, Grace got a weird understanding of the way the internet works. One of the members...
No. I want to save this, Nick.
Go ahead.
Here's the thing. We can't possibly get to everything in this episode. I'm already looking at this for an hour and something.
We're over an hour in, yeah.
I believe what I'm gonna do this month for our bonus podcast, because we're not gonna get everything, I'm gonna do the top 10 stupidest fucking moments in Air Gear we didn't get to talk about, and that's on there, because that is the dumbest fucking thing on the planet when it happens. You're like, this is so dumb, you have three people, and this is one of them!
Okay, we'll skip that. So, let's get to the moment, the fourth head on the Mount Rushmore. Okay. Let's talk about Emily Adachi. I liked Emily Adachi so much up until this moment happens. Emily is introduced as being a character who, Busha, when he's opposing Iggy, helps to bully him in order to kind of break him down. But she ends up kind of getting the situation reversed on her, and she and Nakayama end up helping him in the fight with Bucha. Mm-hmm. And then they get drawn in, and they're observing and watching Kogurasumaru practice and stuff. And through the course of that, Emily very quickly develops a crush on Kazu. She's calling him Kazu-sama, and she is favoring him and being pretty obvious about it.
Yeah.
But Kazu, it's not that he's ignorant of her feelings. It's that he is so focused on improving with air track and so focused on practicing that it kind of, he gets really pulled into it and is a little bit ignorant of her. They even actually go on a date at one point about halfway through the series. And it's actually a really cool little arc that happens because they essentially have a running away from the Terminator sequence where this executioner style rider is after them. He's trying to kill Kazu because he just knows that he's related to Ikki. And Kazu's like, well, if you're an opponent of Ikki's, you're an opponent of mine. I know I'm way weaker than him, but yeah, I'll fight you. And managed to pull off this tricky where Kazu distracts him. And Emily actually comes up behind him and like kicks him off the truck. And then the truck that they're on rams into him. And then he just gets up from it. Kazu's like, I can't do anything but run, and picks Emily up and starts running the fuck away. It's a really, really intense, exciting sequence until finally they're saved by one of Kazu's mentors in the series. I really liked it, and I dug, you know, this much more human character is getting caught up in this world. And that's something that both Kazu and Emily really bring, is normal people caught up in this whole wild sequence of events trying to do their best to contribute. So, cool stuff from her early on. And then the last thing that she gets to do is a big shining moment for her, which is they have this virtual battle against the members of Sleeping Forest, who were the old rulers of the air track world. And an older version of Sora is one of their opponents and stuff. And they have what's called a balloon fight. There are different types of matches in the air track world. One is like just a race. One is just a straight up combat battle. One of them is like ultimate frisbee. And one of them is everyone is trying to chase down this balloon that's floating around this massive arena.
Almost.
Only one person from each team can be the one to grab the balloon. They're called the Panther. And so they make it seem as if Agito is the Panther because he's the best rider. And Agito gets taken out and disabled for a long time while everyone's trying to recover. And they're like, okay, yeah, we're just buying time until Agito can recover. When in fact, it's all distraction so that Emily, the single weakest rider who doesn't have any special techniques, can barely even do any tricks at all, is the one that everyone overlooks. And she ends up taking a leap of faith and grabbing onto the balloon, and then someone's there to catch her, and they win through her efforts and her managing to get up the courage to stand against these monsters and finally make the winning goal. As a result of going to this virtual world, we meet an important supporting character who came into the series out of fucking nowhere. Another supporting character goes to meet with someone who will assist them. President-elect of the United States, John Omaha.
Obama.
Barack Obama.
To be clear to people who are listening, who are like, huh? Remember, this manga ran from like 2001 up until about like 2009, 2010 or so. So it's like peak years. Around the time I think this happened was basically during like the 2007, 2008, like the lead up to the election. Because Obama's in this series, and you know he's Obama not just because he looks like him, but because he utters every catchphrase that Obama had during his campaign trail. Yes, we can. Believe. All that shit. Change. Yeah. All that shit is in there.
Oh, great. Fucked up the English a couple of times, and it was like, to the change or something.
Yeah, his English is not great. So Obama's just in the story. I don't know why. It's not even... All right. I need to look something up before I speak out my ass on something here.
So John Omaha is in the story, and he knows how important air tracks are to the world and the change that they could bring, and also the danger that they can bring to the world for some reason. I don't know why. And so he gives them this explanation. And first off, there is this weird backstory of when he spent time in Africa and he witnessed war crimes.
Here's the thing. All right. I can understand that this is something Ogre might not know, but to be president of the United States, you have to be born in America. And it's a big thing with Obama. Like, he was born in Kenya. He wasn't. He was born in Hawaii and eventually later on moved to Chicago. Like, that's where he grew up. Didn't live in fucking Kenya for a while. In Air Gear, John Omaha seems to have been born and lived in an African country somewhere.
It says he was born in the U.S. and then childhood in Africa somewhere.
I'd have to double check again. It didn't seem to be in the mention that, but either way, it represents the idea that Obama spent a lot of time as a child in like some African nation somewhere and watched bombs destroy and incinerate his family. And after having this big emotional like revelation about this, he sits back and he's like, well, that's why I believe in hope. That's why I believe in air tricks. They can make this world a greater place. And Icky, I will help you and your friends to make this world a better place. And Icky is like crying. He's like, oh, thanks.
What a beautiful story.
And then as the president's getting onto a plane, he's like, great story, but I don't need the help because it wouldn't be worth it if I needed help to get where I am. And Obama's like, I'm glad I told you my very personal and painful story that made me relive my family's death again for you to just throw away my help because you find that cheating for some reason, yet your whole thing is cheating in every fight that you're in.
So Obama comes into this story out of fucking nowhere, and I get to that page and I was like, that's how he comes into it?
Yeah, it's not like a big thing, it's just Obama!
He shows up!
Okay.
So something happens. Something goes wrong. They're like attacked, and the connection gets disrupted very suddenly. As a result of this, Emily and Obama switch bodies.
So Emily, the character we've known as
the 13-year-old girl,
she switched bodies to the president, and now Barack Obama is stuck in the body of a 15-year-old Japanese schoolgirl.
And he immediately starts showering naked, wearing revealing outfits, making jokes that his body is going to grow a mushroom.
It's the strangest fucking thing in the world, because this happens around chapter 220 or so. So essentially like 2/3 of the way through the story. But what's very significant about that, it doesn't get undone until the very end of the series, essentially the last chapter. The entire rest of the series, Emily is just not in her own body, and Obama is in Emily's body, just fucking around doing nothing until he shows up at the end as like a fucking guerrilla warfare soldier in a pair of booty shorts and a half vest.
With a machine gun.
And you're like, what is the point of this? Why did Obama take over?
Why is the president leading this assault?
It makes no sense! What was the point of Obama? He has one thing, and this is going to be on the top 10 list, I'm telling you, because it's still the stupidest fucking thing on the planet. But there is a scene where he goes back to America, to Congress, and he's like, we need to remove patents on air tracks! Everyone needs to fly! This is my goal! This is my moment! Everyone can fly! Everyone gets magic roller skates! And you're like, this was the point? This is why Obama took her character's body? This is why Emily doesn't get to do anything else in this series? Why? This is so pointless! And he's like, a general has to inspire confidence in his men. So I've shown up to this battle in a pair of booty shorts and a vest with no shirt underneath. And I didn't even zip it up all the way. Let's do this, go time, Wolverines!
Oh, I guess that all these soldiers are completely useless. So instead, I'm going to hang out with all the tutors and make jokes about how Karoo and Icky make a cute couple. And then Ringo and Icky basically have sex and they're like, well, shit, I guess I called that horse wrong.
It's like this was his fucking, his I have a dream speech at this press conference where he's just like, air gears are the future of our children and our children's children. It's like, no! They are violent weapons! This series was about skating! They're on a fucking battleship right now with a lobotomized captain! And a man and with robot legs!
And a sadist! Who is a trap, who makes a joke about her elephant, who teams up with a hideous clown-looking masochist, whose body donated organs to his partner so that they could, so that they could fight against Fang.
So dumb.
And then it turns out there's been this tower that extends up to the heavens because it rose up from the depths of the planet and they're going to race down towards the Earth. So even when Ogre does something that I like, he finds a way to punish me for liking it. It's like, oh, Ustum, a low-power human character who is in love with one of the main characters in the story and is doing her best to try and help out the team. Even though she can't do anything, she is trying her best and having success even. She makes an impact because she tries harder than anyone to make a difference with her limited resources. Halfway through the story, I think I'll just stop doing something with her character. Have her sit in Obama's body while Obama proves himself to be a massive pervert who parades her body around so that way I can still draw the character's design in alluring outfits and poses while she herself does jack shit. Until the very end, where I'll pretend that she and Kazu grew to know each other because she confesses to him at the school festival where she and all the other girls that attended the school are wearing fetishy outfits and playing in a band, even though none of them demonstrated any knack for music. Why they're doing this and none of the tutors is fucking beyond me. And she confesses to him and kind of is like, yeah, let's go out. And you're supposed to think that they've grown closer as two people whose souls have connected, even though for the last 150 chapters she's been doing nothing. Fuck this manga!
This is where I enter, like, this is where I want fucking Kazu to be like halfway through their second date, he's like, wait, are you not still Obama? Oh, okay, so, see, revelation time, real talk. I was interested in Obama in your body. It's kind of a deal breaker.
Okay. I'm done. I can't talk anymore about this. Look, I'm going to be upfront about this. We have covered worse manga.
Yes.
On Weekly Manga Recap. We have covered more offensive manga on Weekly Manga Recap. We have covered more, I think we've even covered more shameless manga on Weekly Manga Recap. I don't think we have ever covered a dumber manga on Weekly Manga Recap. This is the stupidest manga we have had to read. It got to the point where I just was like, fine. I have to get through this. I can't question any more of this. And I had to do that for more than half the series because it was so stupid. It was stupid from the get-go, and then the regalia, it turns out the ultimate regalia is connected to literally all technology in the world. And Sora's evil plan is to just give stuff to everyone, and everyone's like, but everyone's crazy!
He's like, they'll self-police themselves, or something.
I represent the 99% of trash in the world, and I will give those 99% weapons to kill themselves for some reason.
Like, I can't stress this enough. This series is weird as shit. This is a series about roller skates that eventually gets heavily involved with clones, with genetic modification, with world
I didn't
ending.
Even talk about the Gravity Children.
No.
The Gravity Children was where I was like, wait a minute. So you were developing personal transportation technology. You got to the point where we were like, we can't unlock the full potential of air drag unless we raise children under zero gravity conditions. So let's do it with literally dozens of them.
Yes. With no government overvision, despite the fact AT technology is sold in stores. Like, there's such this weird disconnect.
Air tracks were never meant to be used as inline skates. What are you talking about?
Yeah, you're like, it's such a weird disconnect from the start of the series where, like, Icky sees a commercial and he's like, man, air tracks. Huh, I really like that girl who rides by with them. Until the end of the series where you're like, no, these things have been secretly running the world for years and we've just never known. Like, there's an entire system that was created to help players exchange parts of one another through battle and this unspoken Fight Club-like system of challenging other teams. And then later on, there are just clones and roller skates that can destroy towns and giant mech suits and all this craziness that you're just like, where did this come from? Like, there's so much death. There's a character gets impaled on a helicopter blade. There's brain control. There's just all of this craziness. A second generation of Gravity Children. A variation of Gravity Children who have had their brains modified.
Like, Icky might be a Gravity Child. It's never actually directly stated, but he can do the things that they do, and he is maybe the son of the guy who created them.
Like,
he's grown up with a family of Gravity Children, so maybe, Agito is something called a brain charger, whatever the fuck that means.
There's so much just absurdly crazy shit in the series that after it reaches about like the third of the way point, just builds upon itself until it becomes so serious and so big that you're like, I don't even know what's happening anymore. Like, the second time reading it, I was able to follow the plot better than I could the first time, especially since I wasn't reading chapter to chapter, but, like, week to week, rather. But it's still, like, a series where you're like, I don't know where this all came from. Like, this is all just so, not confusing, but just convoluted and unnecessary. And then there's just all the pretension of fucking flying and cages and soaring that after 78 chapters of it straight, you're like, enough. And then it's like, well, here's 200 more since you seem to enjoy it so much. And you're like, this isn't deep. This doesn't mean anything anymore. This is the thing. I didn't hate the series this time going through as much as I thought I did the first time. I was like, I'm older now, I can follow the plot a little bit more, I'm just not as, like, easy to anger, I guess. But then, it's just one thing that has to set me off, and it gets me on a trail of, like, 30 different things. So it could just be something as small as, like, fucking Onigiri's a pervert. And I'm like, yeah, and another thing! Fucking Simka's big stupid haircut of importance has her start wearing high heel roller skate stiletto shoes? That's fucking ridiculous. And why does all the Flame Road characters have to shout time every time they fucking use one of their powers? Alright? It doesn't make sense. I get it. They stop time. They're so fast. Why do they say time all the time?
Simka has her big character developing haircut and then becomes a worse character.
Like, it's just, it's one thing that has to set me off. And I'm like, and then this fucking thing happens.
And then there's that one, I've forgotten her name. The one tuner who's has it bad for Iki that everyone just hates. Because she's not right for him. And she gets so caught up in it that it drives her to the dark side. And then she comes back and they're still assholes to her.
She's still a bitch. Like, she's still like fucking being like, I should get to be with Iki now because Karuru is frozen in some weird device murder thing while she builds the regalia. Cause all
you can never allow him to unlock the true potential of the wind regalia. Bitch, she's joined the dark side. Don't push her again.
Like, there's just so much to this series. And sometimes it's funny, stupid. And sometimes you're just like, I don't understand what's happening. But I think what really like just catches me on this series is the fact that this was so absurdly successful. It's not like this is something that ran for a short period of time. Like, I get angry when I'm like, this ran, like, the same length as Cross Barrage 20 times over plus. Like, this ran essentially the same amount of time... Cross Manage. Barrage 2, though. But, like, this ran essentially the same amount of time that Bleach did. Like, and at least Bleach, you're like, well, it had those really good early points. There's no good part of Air Gear. There are moments that are like, okay, I kind of see what's going on here that are kind of cool and able to get invested in. But there's no good point. It's always a bad series with a lot of really stupid elements. And because it ran for so long.
Here are some series that ran for less time than Air Gear, Bakuman, Kuroko no Basket, Beelzebub, Madoka Box, fucking, I think Rurouni Kenshin.
Yeah, I was about to say Rurouni Kenshin probably.
The original Yu-Gi-Oh! Manga ran for less time, I think.
I have over here, I have 12 volumes of the collected series. 12 volumes. That's a shit ton of content to get through. This is essentially one third of the series. It is so much. And you realize it doesn't get better. It was never good to begin with. It's just so much crap all the way through that you're like, how did this, like, it's just infuriating to me on like a point of just like, I just exists. I don't begrudge anybody for enjoying this series. There was a small part of me that probably enjoyed it when I was a teenager, and I think that is the age that you would enjoy this kind of series, because it's full of fan service, it has a lot of fights and action in it, characters are crude and vulgar, and things like that that people would be able to enjoy. But as I get older, I just look at it and I get angry, because I'm like, this ran for so long. Like, people had to absolutely, like, well, not absolutely, it didn't run a jump, but people had to enjoy the series, and it had to sell it for it to get this far, and anytime I see people talking about it, everyone seems to have the same thought of like, it's okay, but the end gets stupid and crazy and it's better just to turn your brain off and read it. And like, that's the people who love it. Like, that's the best praise I've heard of the series, is like, just turn your brain off and enjoy it. And maybe I could try to do that, but there's so much ridiculous fan service that just takes you out of the moment. Or there's so much like, just weird, ill-placed humor, or just dumb moments that you just really can't. I didn't even get to fucking touch on the teacher who's terrified her students are going to assault or rape her. That's treated as a joke.
Or the fact that a big character moment is just a character remembering a scene from Negima. Like, just a full scene.
Oh, I forgot about that! There's, like, 7 panels of Negima in this story for some reason. Like, just in the series!
But look, if we don't stop now, we're gonna be going all night, and we do have more manga to talk about. I think we'll just cut it here. We'll talk about more Air Gear later this month, guys. Like, there's so much to talk about. It's stupid. It's so dumb. It's so fucking dumb. And... honestly, it does make me angry because it makes me think it's symptomatic of this thing where sex sells so much that it trumps everything else. Like, if you see a number of the manga that run in this same magazine, you see it. Like, Kenichi ran the same magazine. And it devolved into shitty fan service the same way, where it was allegedly about one thing, when really it was just an excuse to see them titties. So, it does make me angry when I consider that other better manga aren't getting attention and recognition, or even a chance to be picked up, because they don't draw tits as well as O Great does. So there is that. But honestly, it's like it's such a stupid manga that I think that it's not worth getting angry about. But at the same time, it's so stupid that how can you not?
Yeah, it's just for me, it's a sense like I probably wouldn't mind it as much if it just wasn't so long. And you're just like, I can't believe it's still fucking going as you're reading it. I recommend it for everybody. It's really a classic. It's a cornerstone of the IS industry. Everybody owes it to themselves to read it at least 6 or 7 times, you know, to get all the nuance.
Weekly Manga Recap. Weekly Manga Recap gives it 2 thumbs up and also 2 middle fingers up. Okay.
So, I'm going to be completely honest, Nick. I barely remember Jump this week because I spent so much time reading Air Gear and being angry that most of it just fucking fell out of my head.
We're going to do a really fast recap, okay?
Okay.
We're just going to breeze through this, okay? Recap after Weekly Manga Recap because we have to, but we're exhausted from being angry about Air Gear. Black Clover, page 80, Never Again. Everyone's back from fighting the Diamond Kingdom. Yami is scolding Asta for jumping into battle with 2 broken arms because he's a stupid idiot. He takes him to see a healer, especially really actually kind of creepy-looking healer with glasses. And he is a great recovery mage, one of the foremost in all of the kingdom. And so, Owen, there's his name. Owen starts to use his recovery magic, and he summons this whole this watery surroundings, looks like a bunch of jellyfish surrounding Asta and wrapping around his arms. But Owen notices something, and we cut to Finral on the hallway, and he's like, oh, God, finally I'm out of there. And he happens to witness the recovery magic going on. And while it's happening, Owen removes his glasses, and he starts to say something to Asta, but we don't actually see what it is. We just see that Finral's overhearing it, and everyone who's hearing it is very worried. We cut to the rest of the Black Bulls, who are having a celebration because, as Yami announced, they've actually earned so many stars lately that they're down to 0 black stars. So they've gotten rid of all of their demerits. So as a celebration, he's prepared this big meat feast for them. And, of course, Charmy is like, yeah! So, big celebration, everyone's chowing down and talking amongst each other. Asta has learned to eat shish kebabs with his feet.
Yeah. Of course he did.
So, a bunch of goofing off is going on. Just really a bunch of jokes going on. Like, Noelle sends Asta flying, and so Charmy leaps in front of the meat that's sent flying in order to catch it in her mouth. Finral jokes around by punching himself in the back of his head with his spatial magic. And then Asta all of a sudden is like, I'm kind of tired. I'm going to go nap. And everyone's like, that's kind of weird for Asta. He usually has boundless energy. How the hell, when the hell does he ever get tired? And Finral confides in them all that what he overheard, which is that Owen had said that Asta's arms will never go back to normal. They have been apparently cursed during the battle with Veto. When he crushed his arms, he actually laid a curse in them, shattering the bones and also preventing Owen from being able to heal them with his own magic. And so Yami's like, yeah, so if the top recovery mage in all of the Clover Kingdom says that, then there's not really anything that can be done about it. And so they're like, well, shit, he can't use magic and he can't use his arms. How is he going to fight? How is he going to be a magic knight?
And we cut over to Asta, and he's thinking to himself. He's thinking about the fights that he's had so far. He's thinking of the words that have been told him that he will never swing a sword again while he's thinking of Yuno. And all the black bulls come up.
Well, Asta.
We get a two-page spread of Asta going, "But I'm Asta, so it doesn't matter!" You're so close.
Well, here's the
You're
thing.
So close. I still hate him. I still do. It was a good try. And I'm going to open my mind. I'm going to see where this goes. I still hate him, though.
Here's the thing. I can see why this would be annoying, but he's not saying I've fixed it. He's saying I'm not going to give up. So
right.
It sounds like they still need to go find this person. And if, as long as, you know, like a fight comes up and you can see the notion that like, oh, his arms still don't work. Like, if like every fight that comes up from here on in just has him using the sword in his mouth perfectly fine, then yeah, it wouldn't make sense. Or if he just takes his arms and uses that in the next fight and just doesn't, you know, no-sells the injury, then that would be kind of annoying. But in this situation here, I'm like, okay, like, this is Asta in the best way you can, I guess, because it's him being optimistic in the face of something awful. And that's, I guess, what the core of Asta's character. He's always optimistic, he always believes. So this works for me. I don't know if it needed a two-page spread, but I get it. Like, it works for me in that way. I just have to see, I guess, where we go from here.
Mm-hmm. If only he weren't so Asta about it, you know? Because he's just like, I'm not going to give up, and I'm shouting to the heavens because nobody... Yeah, I'm not going to give up. He's...
Out of curiosity, what's the scene he mentions before, as that's the one last time, that was the very last time I'm going to get depressed for real? Is that a scene we've seen before?
I guess him sitting down by himself was him being depressed.
No, because he references a moment. It's somebody, you see their lips, and he's like, you
see
no matter how much you put into it.
Oh, I don't know. I guess that's someone we haven't been introduced to yet.
Yeah, maybe another character or something like that. And then maybe this is going to be reasoning for why Asta is always so positive. So
I was confused when I saw that guy. I assumed that the time that he was talking about was just when he was, just kind of sitting down by himself.
Apparently, it's chapter one. I'm assuming maybe when Asta couldn't get anything out of his book.
I guess. Well, and also immediately Vanessa's thing to herself. It's okay. Magic from that country might save you. Oh, thanks. Thanks for letting us stew in the dramatic tension for 3 pages. Like,
it's a fast paced series.
I know. God, come on. It could have. It's like there's an opening here where I could start to turn around on him, and I acknowledge that. But at the same time, it just the way that Asta reacts to it once again makes me doubt that I'm going to.
Fair enough.
Let's move on to talk about Fairy Tail.
Okay.
The one Dark Natsu versus Dark Gray.
this one's gonna be real fucking quick because I think I strained my voice screaming here. Chapter 504, The Gash, it's Natsu versus Gray, and Natsu is really angry because when he went Super Saiyan evil, he saw that he had hurt Lucy, or what he thought was Lucy, with her blood, but it was actually, I guess, someone else's, and he, like, lost all sense of himself, and Gray still is under the impression Juvia is dead, so he's angry at all the Book of Xerath demons because they took and his family and now you.
So they're mad for the same reason.
Yeah, they're both, you know, misguided in their anger, and they have the big punchy punch fights. Then there's this, Brandish has this stupid line where she's like, I shrunk my wound, so, you know, the damage still remains, but it doesn't hurt. If only I could shrink my indecision. And that's where I want to be the fucking person on the side, like, lame! That line blows!
Why don't you try enlarging your clothes?
Why don't you try growing a bigger personality? She's like, ouch! And that's basically the chapter. There's a thing at the outside where Irene has put her big eye in the sky, and she used it to basically spot Makarov, and that's it. That's the chapter. Oh, sorry. fucking Mavis does some big illusion.
Forward, my minions!
Does some big stupid illusion of herself with just a garbage speech that doesn't go anywhere, but apparently that was the most inspirational thing anyone's heard fairy tale.
Food Wars Shokugeki no Soma, Chapter 185, Rival Rematch. I like the color page that we get at the beginning of Happier Times for Hayama, when he was doing the booth with Alice and Kurikiba. And we actually cut to Alice and Kurikiba. Soma's on the phone with them, talking about the match with Hayama and how Hayama, of course, has joined the council. And Alice is a bit pissed off about it. But someone's like, oh, and I guess that you guys, since you're part of the resistance, are going to face a council member too. And I was like, yeah, we're just about to head there for our match. I'm going to have to give Hayama a piece of, or she says, I'm so going to have to give Hayama a piece of my mind next time I see him. How can he forget the change in attitude he gained from being part of our lab coat trio? But she also leaves some on the line of, we'll give him a piece of our minds later, so you can beat him now. So, aw, friendship. Companions. Soma gets himself pumped up, but Kurikiba decides to be Debbie Downer and says, you know, if all of you guys are going up against council members, even you don't know if you can win this one. I mean, there is a snowball chance in hell that every single member of the resistance is going to pass, speaking logically. I'm glad that there's someone who is voicing what we've been bringing up for weeks now, that how the hell are they possibly all going to pass? And as we find at the end of this chapter, Megumi might be screwed. But then we just move on to the Shokugeki. Well, it's not a Shokugeki. The challenge between Hayama and Soma. And Dojima, of course, is there to oversee everything. And then we're introduced to the judges. Two of them are a pair of weird-looking twins, Berta and Sheila, who immediately start making judgments based on the fact that Hayama is way hotter looking than Soma. That is true.
I have a point.
And Soma is, you know, kind of laughing about it while being a bit confused, and Kuga says, how can these guys possibly be impartial judges? But Dojima explains that they are actually, disciples of Leonora. Alice is mother and Arina's aunt. And the third judge is actually going to be her husband, who we're introduced to. It's Soe Nakiri, who... There are some weird-looking characters in Shokugeki no Soma. This is a weird-looking character.
Those are eyebrows you have to work for.
Yeah, they look like bats.
They look like batarangs, yeah.
Yeah. He's also got this giant swooping back hair antenna too. So, and they've all got their weird personalities. They're established right away. Berta and Sheila are these lowly looking girls who are fight like children with Kuga. And Soe is, he's a doting father and a doting husband. I love how, he's like, oh yeah, I will judge everything impartially. Even if it were my own daughter Alice in this match, I would judge impartially, even if my decision meant that she lost. Besides, she is objectively the cutest girl in the entire world! Well, but Leonora is also objectively the cutest girl in the whole world. How can I choose between them?
I also like how, Kuga and the twins just are persistently fighting in the background throughout the rest of the chapter. Like, they're just constantly, like, at each other's throats. I just like how childish it makes Kuga out to be more than anything. I guess they're all around the same age, because the twins are 15.
They're 15, and he's, like, 16 or 17.
Yeah, so he wouldn't be too much older, but it's still just the notion of, like, Kuga, you think... I guess because they look so young, you'd be like, Kuga, you gotta be the adult here, but he's literally, like pulling their faces just as much.
They're introduced to the bear meat, and Soe is like, yes, you know, this was prepared to nothing, completely perfectly, the best you could possibly have access to. You can kind of tell that Soma is remembering the advice that the hunter gave him about it, even though there's no, like, actual flashback. But Soma brings it up to Hama, hey, let's, you know, taste each other's dishes the way we did during the Fall Classic, and then, you know, we'll be able to tell for ourselves who's the better chef. And the rest of it is them setting up stuff to prepare everything, and they're each preparing a fried chicken recipe. And someone actually tweeted us about this, saying, like, oh my god, Chris's voice for Hayama in the bonus episode.
Yum, yum, fried chicken, everybody! Made by the master of scent yourself, Hayama!
It's my secret scent and spice recipe that the colonel taught me.
Oh, Hayama's the next colonel.
And this is symbolized by them being like mixed martial arts fighters going on an all-out attack against the other. But that's not where the chapter actually ends, as we see Megumi and Takumi in a waiting room. And they're thinking, you know, talking with each other, being like, yeah, the others must be starting their tests right now. And suddenly Rindo comes into the room. And she says, well, now's not the time to be worrying about your friends, because your tests are coming up, and you're facing off against me. So let's get started. So yeah, second seat on the council is going up against Megumi and Takumi. Now, I said that they're probably screwed, but I get the sneaking suspicion that maybe Rindo will do this in such a way that the more interesting outcome occurs. I don't know. I guess we're going to just have to see what happens. But I mean, now that they've built up the whole, oh, there's no possible way that all of them could pass. But then it's like, well, then what do you do if they don't all pass?
Yeah. I mean, there's ways they could work around it. I just wonder, because I got the weird suspicion from the conversation Alice has that they might lose. Because she kind of puts on there, like, don't bother sending Hayama a message, because I'm going to see him after all this is done and we advance to the next stage. And she knows he's fighting someone on the council but didn't say it. It's like that one day away from retirement sort of thing.
Right.
So maybe this is something where almost all of them fail, or all of them fail, but there's a way to, like, get back in, or I don't know exactly, but it is a situation where it seems like more people could lose. I don't know.
Now, that's the thing about Shonen, is you know that everything's going to work out at the end, but you don't know exactly how. Mm-hmm. You just know that the good guys aren't going to die, probably.
Probably.
Megumi suddenly has a heart attack.
Gay! Heart attack! Ugh! Wait. What's so gay about it? I don't get it.
She's like, oh no, I need you to get angry. What is that? I don't know what you need me to do.
I've got some baby aspirin in the pocket. What was that?
What's that? Medicine in your where?
Oh, the Mamma Mia! They never taught me how to do the CPR. I'll just shove baguettes down your face and hope you will get better. And then I jump in the room. Ha ha! Yatta-da! Yatta-da! Wall kick! Oh, alright. Let's do My Hero Academia.
My Hero Academia, it's the rescue operation test, the second and final portion of the Hero Provisional License Exam. Number 109, Rescue people that were introduced a couple of chapters ago, they are the victims that must be saved. Professional victims that will be judging them as they are being saved. I like how they're still being drawn in super evil way. There's a couple of old men who are limping around, and they're like, hey, I've got the fake blood. But this is a really cool, unique idea that I like in My Hero Academia. They're in because professional hero is such a big thing, there are all these other professionals that are part and parcel of the hero business. So professional rescuees, professional victims that are part of training for this situation. That's cool. After a little bit of discussion between some of the people who are taking the test, by the way, we were corrected. Disguise Girl did pass her test. We were just confused by the Shiketsu students who they were talking about. And we
actually get a little bit of a discussion between a Shiketsu student. I forget if he actually... Yeah, I don't know if he actually introduces himself. He's covered in fur. And he apologizes on behalf of Shishikura for being so damn rude to them. He's like, you know, we actually want to have a good relationship with Yui going forward. Presumably because, hey, we're all going to be professional heroes working together one day. So, so he apologizes. But Todoroki is thinking about the one student whose name I haven't memorized yet, the wind guy. And he's like, maybe I should try that too. And he goes up to him and he's like, hey, have I done something to offend you? And he turns to him and says, well, you have to forgive me. It's because you're Endeavor's son. I hate all of you. You've changed a lot since then, but those eyes look just like Endeavor's. And I like this. I really like that, you know, the fact that Todoroki is Endeavor's kid is getting someone else to hate him. You know, his relationship with his father is a little better now, but Endeavor is kind of a prick, so... Yeah. Not a whole lot really happens in the preamble aside from that, but a little bit of tension with Uraraka looking at the Shiketsu girl who had disguised herself and distracted Deku. And then everyone kind of heads out as the anteroom opens up again. They head into the testing facility, and immediately Deku and some of the other UA students happen to see a child who is crying out, oh, save me, save me. And he runs out towards them and he says, oh, my grandpa's trapped over there. He's being crushed. And Deku says, oh, no, this looks bad. Where is he? And the kid goes, what the heck was that? Points off for you. You should always check if the victim can walk first. Didn't you notice my irregular breathing? And what about the copious blood pouring from my forehead? Those with licenses know that assessing the victim's condition comes first. So, it's a really weird thing that we're going to see from the victims where they'll go from, oh no, help me, save me, oh, help me, no, that was terrible, fuck you! the UA students look around at some of the other students, the students from other schools, and they're immediately taking action, treating things much more professionally, and are much more prepared. And Aizawa is noting in the bleachers, yeah, my kids are kind of behind on this lesson. Probably just, you know, one of the problems with their first year students as opposed to second year students, so the inexperience is showing. And the kid keeps on lecturing Deku and saying, you know, look, you know, we're worried and pain and scared, and the first thing that we hear from you shouldn't be, oh no, this looks bad, that's bad. You know, you should be reassuring us. And so Deku remembers All Might. And contrary to where he was trying to get away from All Might recently in developing this new technique, he now realizes a way that he should be emulating him. And he thinks of something that All Might would always do when he was protecting people. You know, just saying, you're okay because I am here. Everything's going to be okay now. As long as they see All Might's smiling face, he's going to be fine. So Deku gives himself a slap in the face and he's like, oh yeah, I've got to get it together. I've got to pursue my dream. And so he gives the kid a big smile and says, you're okay. And the kid's like, but my grandpa is like, not to worry. I'll save him. And he keeps on giving a big smile. And he says, I'm going to get this kid to the evacuation center so the rest of you can go on without me. And he starts carrying the kid off. He's like, you're okay. You're okay. And the kid finally is like, is that all you know how to say? You suck. And then Uraraka has her own little I've got to get it together moment because she sees Deku clamping down and getting serious and focusing on what's in front of him. And she thinks to herself, I can't be distracted by this. You know, I can't be distracted by these feelings that are starting to well up inside me. I need to bottle them up because when I see him giving his all for his dream, I think it's so cool. Just because I'm crushing on him, you know, I should actually turn that into inspiration and use it to work hard. And she sets off with renewed determination. And that's the chapter, basically.
I hope a payoff comes with the Uraraka stuff, because it's been a couple times now we've gotten focus on it this arc, and thus far nothing's really come out of it. So my hope is that something soon kind of gives us some focus with Uraraka, that she does some kind of move, whether it's pushing forward with Deku or just doing something of her own kind of volition and just something personal for herself, proving herself to be a good hero, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, I think this is going to be interesting. We're seeing the inter-school relationships developing, the rivalries that are we're going to hopefully get more of from now on between the schools, between individual students in those schools. But I like this setup for doing something different, and I like the way that the testers have been set up. So now we'll move on to one chapter 841, To the East Blue. Oh, man, this is such a good chapter, too.
Yeah, we got to pick this up, though.
This is continuing Sanji's flashback. Last time he was left off with the Iron Mask, and honestly, he seems to be coping well with it for at the start of it. He gets his mask unlocked whenever he's fed food, but he, you know, hears up above him outside the prison, Judge praising all the other kids. And he also thinks to himself that, well, he's kind of stuck here and can't do anything. And so he starts to remember when his mother was alive and how he worked hard to make food. And he made this really gross looking thing after mangling his hands to make it. And he carried it off by himself in storming rain, telling a servant, hey, don't tell my father that I'm going off. He headed off, does he go across? I think he goes across a bridge or something like that, but he falls over and gets attacked by a dog as well. So the dish gets messed up even further. So he's greeted by a maid at a hospital. And he's like, oh, you made some food to make Her Majesty feel better. But if it makes Her Majesty sick to her stomach, then who knows? Oh, well, maybe it'll taste better than it looked. Oh! Giant black skull-shaped cloud coming out of her mouth. So she's like, no, I can't. Can't serve that, so. But Sanji goes in to see his mother, and his mother says, did you cook something for me? And he says, yes, I did. And she calls for the maid, Eponine. He's like, oh, I want to see what Sanji brought for me. I don't need this, you know, pre-prepared dish. And she's like, but it was so disgusting. No, Your Majesty, you can't have this. But she gets the dish, and she's like, oh, scrambled eggs, fish, and bananas. And Sanji's apologized because it's all screwed up. It's wet from the rain. It got squashed. But she takes a bite of it and she goes, it's so yummy. And Sanji's face lights up. And then, of course, we cut forward as we hear the voiceover of, will you cook for me again? And Sanji's just looking over her grave.
It's kind of creepy, though, now in retrospect, that Sanji essentially is pining after a girl who looks exactly like his mom.
All of them look like his mom, Chris. All of them look like Nami.
It's Mommy Nami.
So Sanji tried to keep on training himself to be a cook, even while he was in prison. He actually asked for a cookbook and tools, since fuck, he was in prison, why not? He got beaten up by his siblings even when he was in the prison. And this one actually does a lot to establish more of Reiju's character, because she did try to comfort him in some ways, but she was still like, look, they don't have pity or sympathy or sadness like I do, but don't assume that I'm on your soil because I'm doing this. I still don't want to get in trouble with this. But she then finally pointed out to him, we're about to go to climb the Red Line, and we're going to fight a few wars in the East Blue. And just kind of left him with that. And as they were on their way, Sanji said, look, I want to be a cook. And Reiju's like, don't tell me about that stuff. I don't want to know about stuff. But Sanji started to cry. And he was like, if I can escape here in the East Blue, then I'll never have to see Father's face again. And he was crying so hard. Eventually, Reiju was just to pity and said, step back, ripped open the bars and let him outside and was like, look, just take this chance, leave, and then you're not going to get a second chance. Just get out. But Judge actually confronted Sanji while he was getting the key mask, and so he told his father, I'm gonna leave and don't try and stop me. And just like, whatever. You're going to die out there. And Sanji says, don't try and stop me. Well, no, I'm not going to. I actually appreciate this chance. I mean, so I suppose that I'm just fallibly human and too soft and sentimental. Couldn't dispose of my son myself, even a failure like you. But if you just disappear of your own volition, No, I'm not going to stop you. Yeah, you can even take the key for the Iron Mask and just get out. I have just one final request. Never mention to anyone that I am your father. It's a black mark on my success, my secret shame. And Sanji left while crying, and even Reiju was crying because she overheard the conversation. But Sanji left, and Reiju was even giving him one final push. Like, look, there's a ship passing by there. Stop crying. Be a man. You've got to get out there. You've got to get out. You can never come back. And the sea's a huge place. Someday you'll find people who are good to you. I feel like just ending the chapter right there, because, geez, like, oh.
It's a bit brutal, yeah.
It's really brutal. Like, we were commenting on Reiju kind of being almost more evil because she took a passive role despite feeling some empathy towards Sanji. But now you can tell is that, there was at least enough love there that she wanted to get him out of that bad situation. And it makes me feel more empathy towards her and her situation. Or she really was too scared to do anything, but she could at least protect this one person with this action.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you definitely get to see what kind of person she was.
And she's actually scolding Sanji back in the present by saying, I told you, you know, if you had never come back, then this would have been settled. Why'd you come back? Why would you come back to a place that you never wanted to even remember? Of course, Sanji was forced to come back. But, yeah. So, good stuff. And for a complete mood whiplash, going from one of the saddest moments in One Piece and one of the funniest I can remember. Yes. Luffy is still fighting against Biscuit. Against Cracker, rather. Nami's still overlooking everything. Luffy is fucking huge and fat. And he complained, I can't eat anymore! And Cracker says, who asked you to eat my biscuit soldiers? And Luffy says, biscuits are food!
I do love that that's essentially how that fight went. It's just, like, after Luffy realized he produced soldiers of biscuits, he's like, I can eat them all!
That's so fucking... He's just this giant rotund man on spindly little arms and legs. He's like, why are you eating them? Because they're food! I'm sick of biting you! Stop running away! Oh, man. That's the end of One Piece. I fucking love this chapter. A really weird mood whiplash at the end, but super emotional through most of it, and then super funny at the end. So, you wanted to do Promised Neverland first, and then Red Sprite, right?
Yes.
Right?
Yes, that is correct. That's how alphabetical order would go.
That's how it would work without the... which is often omitted because it's a direct, an object, right? Crone plays tag with the kids in chapter 9. Let's play tag. She catches all of them and, displays a tremendous amount of cunning. She's got seemingly endless stamina, and she also manages to lure kids in by having them curiously check in a number of objects. At one point, a kid hides in a bunch of shrubs that are too small for her to creep into, so she just rips them all apart in order to get to them, just pummels them all and then grabs them. Emily tries to take two smaller kids away from her, but in doing so, that ends up being her own undoing. She can't get away with them together when she might have on her own, and that's, you know, reiterated as being her greatest strength and her greatest weakness. So in the real confrontation that's going on, when is that actually going to, how's that actually going to play out? But then Ray and Norman are left as the only prone to catch, and they make a plan together, and Norman actually manages to manipulate her somehow through misdirection and such, even though he doesn't have nearly as much stamina as Ray and Emma do. He manages to actually buy time while getting away from her, and then right as time expires, Ray comes up behind her and snatches her watch and says, oh, it looks like we won. So Crone is thinking to herself, this is what Mom was talking about. It's not that these kids have perfect scores. There's something special about them beyond even that. And she even notes that the other older girl, the one with the glasses,
she thinks that she's special too, but potentially. And I do want to see more, you know, like more special kids get introduced into this. But Ray concludes, rather Norma concludes, okay, this is what information we gathered from this tag. We've got to divide all the kids into groups so that the more capable ones can make up for those who can't really look after themselves. We're going to have to escape in squads. We can't all escape together. And we also found out one more thing. We can attack her from behind. So it's possible that we could kill her.
It's kind of dark, but I like the way she broke down the kids. Kind of gave us some details about them we didn't know, like Norman being physically...
From a newcomer's, outsider's perspective, yeah.
The hints that the one glasses girl might actually be more important than was being let on. And also that she dropped that she knows that they're the ones, like, to them, or at least to Emma, that like she figures they're the ones who saw the harvest. So now they know directly that at least Crone knows, and they could presume from that Mom probably knows too. Like, I think they already knew that they already were the ones being suspected, but having that drop is kind of a broken kayfabe, I guess, to say.
Yeah. Let's do Red Sprite. Let's just do both chapters in one go, because they're all one fight scene anyway. A battleship attacks them, called Excalibur, and they manage to set up a gambit with Mono, because they put him essentially in a distraction pod, and their radar detects the distraction pod in the clouds and not the main ship, which manages to sneak up on the battleship. Tatsu infiltrates the bridge, and the commander of that battleship uses a special rifle that's designed to take them out, to take out the human Blasmeros, but Tatsu manages to just kind of power through it and redirect the lightning and take him down, and then he crashes the battleship in the ocean and then makes off in victory. The female lieutenant seems like she might be important later down the line. That was on the battleship.
There's a lot of focus on her.
There. Had a quick one. I don't even actually remember Toriko especially well, though. And that's our last chapter.
Yeah.
So.
If no world trigger, this is what you did to me, Ashiara.
We would have actually bothered to get full recaps if we had world trigger. Yeah. It's Gourmet 389, The Taste You Can't Stand. The only thing that I really remember is that Pear tells Toriko that the taste that Neo loves is despair, but the one that he can't stand is anger.
Yeah.
And so
it's essentially like it starts with the gourmet knight or whatever just seeing the world of food, and then yeah, as you said, Pear basically freezes Toriko and is like, rage is what he hates, and it seems like Acacia's is able to actually consume food luck. And it basically looks like Toriko's been frozen and will have to watch Midora be killed. And that will bring out his rage and help him, I guess, be a necessary opponent to actually fight Acacia. That's what I'm presuming, but yeah. That's what it seems. Because Acacia has Midora on the ropes now, especially if he can just eat food luck.
Okay. Yeah, and Acacia does this huge thing where it's like, I'm going to crush the whole world! And one of the hands gets repelled, but he's like, I'm just going to summon a bunch of them!
Fuck you.
It's weird how that happens. Yeah, I don't have really a whole lot to say about it, but Midori is kind of getting his ass kicked, and Acacia observes that he's out of...
Also, we do see Komatsu had a conversation with his food demon, which is actually kind of nice, because he talks about, like, the food demon talks like, oh, yeah, well, don't you remember what Toriko's first ingredient was? He's like, oh, the rainbow fruit. I remember when we shared that together. And he's like, the ingredient is you and Toriko's perfect ingredient. And I was like, oh, that's kind of sweet.
So, yeah, that's going to do it. Yeah, this has been a roller coaster of an episode recap. Thank you guys for joining us. We're done now, with Air Gear. I'm so happy. Wait, no, we're not done. No, there's so much more to talk about. No!
Not fully done. We still have that to do.
So much more venting to do. So look forward to that sometime later on this month, guys. In the meantime, you can watch our regular episodes on hitbox.tv/RollOT, normally Wednesdays at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, assuming that Skype is not bullshit for an hour, and we managed to start on time. But we'll keep you updated if you follow us on Twitter. You can follow him at RollOT. You can follow me at YRollerTime. You can follow the official @DeMora podcast Twitter account as well.
Yes.
We'll try. Check out our past episodes on weeklymangarecap.podbean.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes. Leave a comment and rating if you check us out on iTunes, because that helps us beat the woodworking podcasts. And we're on YouTube, too.
Yes. We need that. We need that help.
Be sure to send criticism, ask us questions, make suggestions for future manga for us to read in the comments section if you happen to be listening to this on YouTube, or you can email them to us as well, weeklymangarecap@yahoo.com. Email is the best way to do all that stuff.
Oh, we need to do our MVPs.
Yes, we do. We'll do it. Let me get all the plugging out of the way, and then you can get the MVPs, yeah. Special thanks to our Patreon supporters. Your support allows us to create bonus content for you guys to enjoy. Thank you guys so much. You got us to air gear, so yeah. sky's the limit from here. You guys are our feathers. You guys are our feathers that will form wings, that will allow us to fly above all the cages in the world, into the sky, and ride on the wind, which is freedom.
And we're all born with wings, I'll have you know, which is all just born a lie. I want to note, I take notes of the series as I read them, and I put them together in like a OneNote. My first note on Air Gear was fucking Patreon. But no, I do want to thank a couple people, our newest patron. Sorry, I had this open before until I had to restart my whole machine in the vain attempt to try to get Skype to work. But I want to give a special thank you to Robert and Tim Gaughan, who are our newest patrons, so thank you very much, both of you.
You can check out all that stuff that our helpers do as well. Steve Mann, artwork. And for once, when there were all sorts of tits to choose from, he didn't go for that this time.
No.
No.
I appreciate that. I like that in the whole thing of Obama switching bodies with a 15-year-old Japanese schoolgirl, he went with the image of, I guess, Emily in Obama's body.
Might as well. Fair is fair, asshole.
If you want to, because I had some people in the chat ask for it too, if you want a full version of that, if you go to Steve Mann's Patreon, he has it available, so you can download that and use it as a wallpaper or prank it on some of your friends' phones or something like that. You can get it.
Yeah, check out this hot photo of Emily from here.
Yeah, I got this sweet picture of Obama. Want to see it?
of course, special thanks as well to Infamous Planet, who I'm sure could very easily have done a collage of stupid fucking moments from Eric here if he wanted to.
He actually lamented that. He's like, oh, if I didn't have to read Egg, I wanted to do one, because this episode with some pomp and circumstance had been good, but he just didn't want to read Air Gear.
I would never ask someone to read Air Gear in order to create something for me.
I don't
me.
Blame
never.
Him.
No. So, okay, yeah. We are going to, now name our weekly, favorites. That's what they're called now, weekly yes. favorites, instead of anything else. I am going to go with One Piece again this week. Emotional chapter with I am not exaggerating. I think the made me laugh harder than any moment in One Piece has for the last couple of years.
Oh, wow.
I just loved the incredibly simple solution of they're made of biscuit. I'll eat them. That's going to be it for me.
My favorite this week was Food Wars. I really got excited for it. I like the way they built in that both Soma and Hayama are both going for a deep fried dish. Like the way they portrayed it just feels like an epic build up to a fight I'm really excited for. And I liked all the other teases we got within it.
And our audience once again shows One Piece as well. Sanji flashback has clearly been getting some favorites for the last couple of weeks. Who's my weekly MVP? God damn it. I don't know.
Even on my second time through, I was like, who the fuck's my MVP? God, I fucking hate Air Gear. Those stupid fucking high heel roller skates. I think I just went with Sanji. Not just. It was a good chapter for him, but like...
Right.
Seriously, most of this week just I didn't... Normally I read the chapter on Mondays and like I'll tweet thoughts. I forgot to even read it until like 10 o'clock Monday night just because I had been binging on Air Gear. And even as I was reading it, it just all left my mind. So nothing sticky with me this week, unfortunately. But I remember Sanji being pretty cool.
And I'm going to go with Reiju, I think. Because after we talked about her, I was she took a different direction than I was expecting her to. And I really like the whole thing. She did a big favor for Sanji, but now that he has come back, she's kind of like, well, I gave you one chance. What do you want me to do now? I'm just going to get in more trouble. You know, you ruined your chance. But did express a lot of, you know, unexpected emotion after she was kind of like, ha, ha, ha. No, I just don't want to get in trouble. Ha, ha, ha. You know.
Yeah.
That's it. Suggestions. We are in Halloween month, and we're actually going to take a Halloween series, Halloween-related series now. Full disclosure on why I'm choosing this. I'm going to be on a trip for most of the next week. So I'm not going to have as much manga reading time. I just wanted to actually get us doing Halloween related stuff. So, it's a series called, what? Did I actually seriously close the goddamn door? Yeah, I did. God damn it. It's, fuck.
Well, in times like this, let's just open up some Air Gear and see what we can enjoy from it. Let's see. Why did I bookmark this one? Oh, Simcoe worked at a roller skating store for a while. Okay. I don't know why I bookmarked that. She must have said something important. Oh, and here's Simcoe naked in an apron serving food. Again, volume 2. So, you know, that's pretty good. Let's see what this page is. This could be a treasure trove. Oh, here's Simcoe, first saying that she was gonna promise something to somebody if they won, and everyone's like, oh, it's gonna be your tits. And then, like, she, gave him a kiss, and they're like, oh, that's not that. And then she runs back, and she takes her shirt off. So, you know, you get that.
Yep.
Oh, but then this is that sweet page where Bucha's flying through the air, and he's happy.
Aw, he's happy. He's happy. He looks like he would be an interesting character. Yay.
I do like Bucha.
I wish I could like him more, honestly. Come on. He's so slow.
I feel like if a character is liked by me, they're destined to be underappreciated and not.
No, Chad!
Yeah, it really is. Oh, man. Oh, right. And then there's this weird chapter where Onigiri has a girlfriend with huge tits. And then at the end, she just breaks up with him for Bucha because Bucha's fatter and she's into fat dudes.
Yeah, she only likes large men. Yeah. I've got it. I finally got it.
Are you sure?
It's called Save Some for the Bonus Pod. Fuan no Tane is the name of the series. It is a collection of very short, weird, creepy stories. I read through some of it. I think it's going to be weird to talk about, but it's also going to be a very quick read for us. So to make up for our gigantic conversation that we had this time, we're going to have one that might not even last 15 minutes next time. And we'll be able to focus on the chapters that came out. But it is Halloween related. It's very story to tell around a campfire.
Like, are you afraid of the dark?
A little bit. Except instead of a full episode dedicated to each story, it's like the first 2 minutes.
Huh.
Yeah.
All right. I can dig it. Well, boosh. That does it.
That is it, everybody. Thank you for joining us for a very special episode of Weekly Manga Recap. I'm done.
I get shit-faced and fall asleep.
Yeah, one more episode and then one more little discussion, then we never have to think about the series.
Until it comes up inevitably on top 10 lists or questions.
Oh my god!
I'll never escape it. This is my white whale, except the white whale is something I could just continuously catch, but I let go so I could catch it next time and hope it's bigger. Oh, I think that analogy would have made more sense if weren't so sleep deprived, angry, and tired. Goodbye, everybody.
Bye!